Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Davis Malm. Their tax lawyers are committed to your most taxing matters. Learn more at davismalm.com. That's DAVISMALM.com. Davis Malm, lean, agile, strategic.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, we're starting off talking about this weekend's news about the emergence of a new COVID strain they're calling the Omicron variant, while the New York Times calls it a Frankenstein mixture of mutations. There's still a lot we don't know, including how effective the current vaccines are against it, but in the interim, we thought we'd do a check-in. How are you taking the news? And does all this change how you plan to celebrate Christmas? How you're living your life? Take your calls.
Then Washington Post columnist Michelle Singletary on tips for dodging holiday season scams and advice for staying both frugal and thoughtful as you're buying gifts for family and little ones. Then Governor Charlie Baker will join us on Boston Public Radio from 12:30 to 1. All that ahead, 89.7 GBH. GBH, Boston Public Radio. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm excellent, thank you. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving.
I did indeed, particularly reading about the Omicron variant. That was some of the highlights of the weekend. I tried to do a little bit of it every day during the days we were off.
Okay.
So speaking of, the nation's top doc, Anthony Fauci, says the emergence of the Omicron COVID-19 variant should not be cause for panic, but instead should motivate us to get vaccinated and sign up for boosters. You just heard the governor, who will be with us at 12:30, and Mayor Wu say much the same thing about vaccinations. All indications are that patients with a new variant are showing mild symptoms. However, we still don't know how effective the vaccines will be against its spread. And there is a sense of impending dread in the air, even though I think we should wait. And we want to check in with you to get a sense of how you're feeling, considering so little is known and probably won't be known for at least days, if not a couple of weeks. After gathering with a family for Thanksgiving or opting not to, whatever you did, we want to get your reaction to the news about this new variant out of Southern Africa. The number is 877-301-8970, or you can email Marjorie at bpr at wgbh.org. I'm sure you're taking this in stride, are you not?
Well, I mean, it just seems to me this is going to be with us for a while. You know, that's what this seems to
me. You don't mean
me.
The variant. You mean COVID-19
in
general.
It's going to be with us for a while. Yeah. And if everybody got vaccinated, we wouldn't have to worry about this anymore. But people aren't getting vaccinated. You know, in some other countries around the world, in Africa, some parts of Africa, it's less than 10% because people can't get the vaccine. So I suppose it's not surprising that these kind of variants would come from countries where the people there are unable to get the vaccine.
Which, by the way, that shows that vaccine equity is not just about selflessness, right, you know, caring about our fellow human beings, but it's also about protecting ourselves, you know?
That's right. I'm more hostile than ever toward the unvaccinated.
You are?
If they can get it.
And if they can get it,
and
right,
people in the United States of America can get it. So my hostility level is increasing, Jim, I must admit.
Well, you know, I was feeling actually okay about this, and I was staying calm as I was stuffing.
Not you. You would not be calm ever.
Until I read the reference in the New York Times referring to this as a Frankenstein mix of mutations. That sort of put me over the edge. And the WHO, which is apparently upset about these travel bans, which seem to make sense to me, but maybe someone who calls will know more about it than I do, a variation of concern, which is apparently a fairly high a criterion or at least qualification or characterization by the WHO. But you know, the one thing that is so clear to me, we were going to a friend's house and they asked if we do the rapid test before.
Yep.
First of all, it took me, and I'm not exaggerating, I would say 4 hours to find rapid tests. Walgreens was out. In my neighborhood, CVS, finally we found some. They cost $24, which is the cheapest I've seen for two. And I'll say what I've said repeatedly, but feel even more so in light of this variant. Why is Joe Biden is speaking sometime this morning. We'll bring you information on whatever he has to say as quickly as he says it. Why are these tests not readily available and free?
Well,
I mean, most people can't afford before they go over to somebody's house to spend $12 for every family member.
Plus,
Nor can they even find the damn tests.
If you read the directions, as I'm sure you do because you worry about all these things, most of the time they tell you to take two over 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to take more than one. So that's
Because the reliability is lower mm-hmm. than obviously the mm-hmm. PCR thing.
Yeah, so it's not $12, it's $25. Why aren't those free? Why aren't they easier to get or certainly not $25? And why is it so hard to get boosters? I mean, we're all supposed to get boosters now. Have you tried to get a booster lately for somebody in your family?
It's hard. I know. Well, I got one, as I told you, hours after it happened. But I think...
Jim canceled everything to go out and get the booster.
I actually did. I also paid off the pharmacist, but that was totally off the record, and she said she wouldn't mention it. But can I say one other thing? I think some of us, I myself, and then I got over it. The fact that the New York Times is using the term Frankensteinian or whatever it's using, we shouldn't overreact to, because they use that as relates to a lot of things. 877-301-8970. The most important thing is the thing you said here, is people have got to get with the equity thing here. This is not about being kind to people, for example, in South Africa or these other nations in Southern Africa. It's not about being kind or being a citizen of the world kind of thing, which I know in 2021 is deeply offensive to a lot of people in this country, even though we are citizens of the world in 2021. If it turns out the overall fully vaccinated rate in South Africa is 25%, that's one of the reasons why this variant has potential to be a huge threat to us. If they were vaccinated at the same level as we are here, which is not even close to what it should be, here being in the United States, I mean, then it probably there's not the ability for these mutations to happen because there aren't as many fertile bodies for this
correct.
Kind of thing to happen.
That
so
is correct.
People have even people who have insane positions on this, and you know the U.S. is all you care about. Even if you're not, some of those people aren't even getting a vaccine. People have to start worrying about getting vaccinations to other people on this planet, or else this is just going to be happening
all
the time.
And of course, it's what's today, November 29th.
Yeah.
So you know we're only a few weeks away from Christmas, right. And everyone's Christmas plans. I know you're a social butterfly at Christmas.
I am a social butterfly. Yeah.
Trying to decide, should you go to any? If you're invited to a Christmas event, you know, are you going to go?
I actually have a solution to that. I wasn't going to say
that, Jim?
To one of our Christmas shows.
Uh-huh.
One of the best ways to address the issue whether you should go to Christmas parties is not to get invited to any, which apparently as of November 29th, I may be the only person in the media who's not been invited to one Christmas party by anyone.
Jim, you and I are hosting a Christmas party for our staff. I mean, what do we do?
Well, we do that every year.
I know, but it's an issue, right?
Well, actually, you didn't see my email. I said they couldn't come. So we are hosting it, but unfortunately,
and going to an event, which will be crowded.
We're going to Ryan Landry. We've said that.
With people.
Ryan and his cast are their people, and we love them all. In any case, 877-301-8970. How are you reacting to the news, which is totally incomplete? By the way, I assume the governor will be able to give us some update at 12:30. You know, he must know something we don't. Obviously, he's dealing with the feds all the time. How are you reacting to the news over the weekend about this Omicron variant? Tim in New Hampshire, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Personally, I'm not that too concerned about the variant. I've had my three-shot regimen.
Good.
But I have a positive story I want to...
Great.
I live in a small, conservative hill town about 15 miles from the Mass line,
mm-hmm.
population like 2,500 people, and courtesy of the state of New Hampshire, and I think they got the funding for it from the federal government, but we had a rolling vaccination clinic that came and visited our and we had almost 400 people come through on a Saturday.
Wow.
And stand in line up to an hour to get vaccinations. And I have to tell you, I know a lot of the people in the town. I'm a selectman in the town. And a lot of people that were there getting vaccinations were getting their very first shot.
Wow.
I'm hoping that's going to make Marjorie feel a little better. And the clinic is coming back on the 30th of December to give all those people that got their first
shot.
Or second
Great.
Shot either a second shot or a booster.
Great.
Everything was offered. I was there for several hours being one of the town fathers, and a lot of children came through that had just turned 5 years old, and it's just a positive thing that I want to relate because things might be getting better in terms of people realizing what's happening.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Tim. I mean, that is a good story, and thanks. We need good stories. But what do you think it was? Was it news of this new variant, or was it just that people had time over Thanksgiving weekend? Why hundreds of people in this tiny town now?
I think it wasn't so much news of this new variant as the fact that we've been featured on the late night TV, and it wasn't a positive comment that was made about Maine and Vermont and soon to be Massachusetts. We have the highest case count of the whole thing, including 2020. And I think people are waking up to the fact that you need to get vaccinated
what was the
or
news?
Else you're going to get really sick.
Well, what's the town? You haven't told us.
What was the news show? Oh. Who trashed you on TV, Tim? Do tell.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Well, I guess we're not going to hear that. Well, I hope that whole story is true. I assume it is. He sounded convincing to me. Thank you for the call, Tim. 877-301-8970. You know, he did say we lost him. The connection was pretty bad at the end here. He said it wasn't motivated by the variant. Is that what he said?
He said it was not.
So I hope
it was motivated. He said by this mention on some late night show or something.
I don't know. But in any case, the plus with the variant, I mean, there's nothing we can do about it. Is it may scare some people into getting, as you know, Fauci on Downer saying, get those boosters.
Don't people want to be through
vaccinated.
With this? Aren't people tired of this? Don't you want to be done with this? You know, and we're not going to get done with it unless everybody gets a vaccination.
Now, are the nuts going to say, those who have access, I characterize as the nuts, access and choose not to get the thing, that this variant proves that the vaccinations don't work? They're going to bastardize the facts and say, this is why we're not getting a vaccination, because doesn't stop variants? And is that what we're going to hear? I assume it is.
I don't know. Listen to this. This is from Shana. She says she's listening from New Hampshire. And as of today, residents of New Hampshire can order free rapid tests online. She entered her address and 4 test kits should arrive within a week. Wow. Jim is checking this out, but she said it's about time. And that is about time. That's absolutely fantastic.
Well, why don't we ask the governor if he has assuming that's true, and I assume it is, we should ask the governor here if that is something that is being contemplated, you know.
Let's go to Georgia.
Well, let me just hear. This is from WMUR, free at home. This is great, by the way.
Yeah, thank you, Shana, for advising us.
Thank you,
us.
Shana. Free New Hampshire residents can now request free at home COVID-19 tests. That is really terrific. Each person in a household, meaning a family of 4, can request 4 test kits, 8 tests overall. Governor Sununu said 1 million rapid tests are available. Can you guys check and see if Governor Baker has said anything about rapid tests and possible availability and let us know? But if not, we will ask the governor when he joins us at 12:30. That's really great news.
You know, Paul just sent us an email saying that this unvaccinated friend of his felt horrible on Thanksgiving, tested positive for COVID yesterday. His 90-year-old mom, whose health was already failing, is in the ICU now. It's not clear from this email whether the mom has COVID, but what is clear is that his son or her son is not going to be able to visit her, even if he were allowed in the ICU with COVID restrictions, because he himself has COVID. Mm-hmm. And Paul says he asked his friend why he didn't get vaccinated earlier. He said, I just didn't think I needed it. I never get sick and I don't get a flu shot. I figured I'd probably get one eventually. And now I wish I'd done it, because now he has COVID. George in Dartmouth. Hi, George.
Hello, George.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks, Marjorie and Jim, for taking my call.
Thank you.
I had 2 thoughts on the on Omicron. One is, I pretty much agree with Cyril Ramaphosa, the president of South Africa, and an epidemiologist, from Johns Hopkins, who spoke on it, that just as you can't contain immigrants who want to cross borders for asylum, you can't stop a virus from crossing borders. And that's why the whole emphasis needs, I think, not to be on travel bans. The emphasis needs to be on how the developing world can help the less developed world catch up on vaccinations. And that should be the emphasis that should be led by all the governments of the developing world. Let's vaccinate as fast as we can so that the mutants of these different viruses don't mutate further and spread, because we're a global world and it will affect all of us. And secondly,
hey George, before you really get to secondly, before you get to secondly, why can't you do both? I mean, I feel bad. I assume that's part of where you're coming from, that people are suffering the most, that suffer doubly when there's a travel ban. But why isn't that of some value in addition to pushing vaccinations, as you suggest?
Because I don't think travel bans, in of themselves work.
In of themselves. Okay.
You have to put the emphasis.
I got it.
You have to put the emphasis on vaccination.
Got it. What's your second point?
And the second point is, I think it's unfair to penalize a country and its health system, which alerted the rest of the world to the existence of this virus. And the problem is that it may, you know, tell other countries who have similar viruses, mutations, that this is what will happen to you if you let the rest of the world know. I just think it was unfair to single them out because they were honest and they alerted the rest of the world to this danger.
George, thank you for a thoughtful call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970.
Laura says, we're in the middle of a COVID outbreak in my home. Three adults and a 16-month-old baby had the virus, picked up from my daughter's place of work. The trickle-down effect was insane. That one employee infected my daughter, who infected me, and I went to work, so 20 people had to go get COVID tests. And let's just say nobody's very happy with me right now, although they all tested negative. She said they were all vaccinated, by the way, but we were still pretty sick, and she definitely does not want to go through this again, and she does not wish it on anybody.
Isn't she the perfect example for the rapid test that before she went to work, she should have had an available and hopefully free rapid test?
That's a great point.
She went to her office.
But sometimes, of course, I don't know if she had one available or not, but sometimes, you know, you take the test at 8 o'clock in the morning and you don't show you're positive till 6 o'clock at
night.
But
is it better than no test?
It's better than nothing.
Right.
Stephen says, in Nova Scotia, the home tests are given away free. At a recent Santa Claus parade in Halifax, elves were shouting, ho, ho, home test kits.
Really?
Yes.
Well, like 9 people in Nova Scotia, though. I mean, I'm serious. How many people are in Nova Scotia?
I don't know.
I could buy them all test kits. I know. I hear it's beautiful, too.
Dan from Needham, thank you for calling.
Hey, Dan, what's up? We're talking about Omicron. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was boiling before, but now I'm like spilling over. The whole idea that we haven't forced the small number of vaccine manufacturers to give up their intellectual property rights. They've made, you know, Pfizer has made $30 billion this last year alone. Moderna is making money hand over fist. And the United States government worked intensely to develop the vaccine to the tune of $10 billion in its efforts to help Moderna. And Moderna won't even recognize the very important government scientists that helped them, help create the vaccine. It's outrageous. You know, we have, talk about travel bans, talk about border walls, talk about keeping immigrants out. The walls are just going to have to go, the walls are going to get higher and higher if we're not going to share important technology to help stop the development of more and more of these variants.
You know, Dan, you probably know more about this than I, so I'll direct it at you. What you describe is troubling, but at the same time, correct me if I'm wrong, don't Merck and is it Pfizer who are doing the antiviral pills? The bad news we learned this week, and they're not quite as effective, Merck is, as originally projected. They are making the formula available at no cost to not all, but much of the rest of the world. Is that to basically distract attention away from what they're doing on the vaccine front, do you think?
Well, I don't know that I want to be that conspiratorial. I don't know what's going on with the pills to help limit the effects that they've developed recently. Except you're right, they determined that one of them was not as effective.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm pretty much focused on the the repeated situation where the risk is socialized and paid for significantly in the development of important things. For society, but as soon as they're developed,
that's a great point.
All the risks, all the gains are privatized, and that's what's happening with the vaccines. And it's awful. The terms that Pfizer is forcing countries to sign on to, especially Brazil, are criminal. Brazil can't accept donations from anybody else. Brazil cannot make donations to anybody else. There's a private arbitration panel with three members that's held in secret. If Pfizer wants to bring suit against any country that signs on with them, it's really egregious. So I really think that we need to focus on pushing the president and our representatives to use the Defense Production Act to force the recipes to go. I don't like the idea that the United States, I mean, it's great. The United States is buying millions and millions of vaccines and then giving them away, but we don't have to do that. It's a little bit, it's more than patronizing. It's a little bit racist. It really needs to be manufactured around the world at places that have already proven they can do it.
Dan, that's a great call. Thanks for making it. We appreciate it.
We're talking about the emergence of the Omicron variant. That conversation continues on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marge Regan and Jim Browdy. If you're just tuning in, we're discussing the Omicron variant, how you're handling this news that is far from complete. Again, we're hoping the governor, we don't know, but when the governor joins us at 12:30, I'm assuming he knows more than we do. I'm sure he'll share whatever he does with us. The president is doing some sort of press availability, press conference, speech, statement on the state of affairs, which we will bring you news on as soon as he does that. 877-301-8970.
Paul in Marshfield, thank you for calling.
Welcome, Paul.
Oh, hey, thanks, Jim and Marjorie.
Sure.
Yeah, I think I'm waiting for more information, but my understanding is that it's going to take about a week for scientists to kind of totally wrap their heads around what it is and the ramifications. But I feel like internationally, we should use the J&J vaccine for vaccine diplomacy because it ships easier. The mRNA ones, they need really cold temperatures, and it's just not practical. And I just think maybe the government should make some deal with Pfizer or Moderna just to guarantee them some sort of profit, because this is kind of like a lifeboat where everybody's chained together, and if one person falls overboard, it drags everybody else with them.
You know, the one thing you reminded me that I meant to say, this is a piece of good news after the bad news from the prior caller, Paul, is apparently because the two-dose vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, are based on this mRNA technology, the ability of them to alter the vaccine if this variant requires an alteration is apparently almost at warp speed, meaning I think I read last night as quick as 6 weeks potentially, which is pretty incredible. So, you know, there are pros and cons. And Paul, thank you much for your phone call. We appreciate it. But I mean, the bottom line from everybody is they got to get these vaccines, however it is done, out to the rest of the world as quickly as possible, or we're going to keep having variants of concern, to quote the WHO, nonstop.
Colin says he's been trying to get the booster for 2 weeks. No luck. Check Vax.com, CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid. Can't find a spot even 2 weeks out, and he's checking 3 to 4 times a day.
I've spoken to a lot of people, by the way, and I was spoiled because I did do it the first day when people barely knew it was out. I literally saw on CNN when we left the studio, it was approved, and I literally drove right to, I mean, I didn't break any rules, Margie.
No.
I drove to Walgreens.
You are a very cautious hypochondriac.
When I did chain myself to the pharmacist saying that I would not leave until she did what I wanted. But apparently, this is nowhere near, from what I understand. I'm not belittling the problem for those trying to get boosters. This is nothing like in the early phase of the vaccine thing where the system was crashing. And
no, but you know, I feel a little bit lucky because I had the Moderna, which supposedly the efficacy lasts longer.
Yeah.
But if you had the Pfizer in March, you're way past the time when its efficacy is supposed to decrease, not hugely, but significantly.
Well, pretty significant. I read yesterday from February to October, the efficacy is down to like high 40-some percent from 90s.
It does seem to me that it's, it would be a good idea to be, make these boosters more widely available.
Well, you know who says – Art Kaplan says it great, is that it shouldn't even be called a booster. It should be called the third shot. The new conventional wisdom should be if you're a Pfizer or a Moderna person, you have three shots to be fully vaccinated.
Correct.
If you're a J&J person, you need two shots to be fully vaccinated.
Derek from New Hampshire, thank you for calling.
Hello, Derek.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Fine, thanks.
I don't think we'll ever really get ahead of the virus until we start being proactive about testing, just like we should have done at the beginning, right? Like, all same thing with South Africa, right? Like, we're 2 weeks behind in all of this data. So, like, you know, I just don't think that you're going to see, like, any kind of proactive approach until you start treating it like that. And when you're reactionary, this is what happens. People freak out. You know, border crossings, whatever, you know, it's an emotional response, not a logical response, in my opinion.
Well, Derek, I'm with you. And the testing thing has never been important enough here. And particularly now, it's got to be the critical ingredient. Derek, thanks for the call. Before you go to a social gathering, you got to have a test. And the reality is most people can't afford $12 for every person in their family before they go to a social gathering. So it's got to be free and readily available, as apparently, not apparently, as it is now in New Hampshire. Why are you smiling?
I'm just smiling because I'm
Oh, this is one of these things where Marjorie has something going on. Well, I'm not going to let you do this. The listeners all want to know. What are you smiling about?
I just got a text about someone getting a booster.
Oh, you did?
And yes, and I was happy that the person got the booster.
Because of you? Because you pushed him or her to do it?
That's correct.
That's not true. Is it true?
It is true.
And they were a resistor until you got involved?
No. It was hard to get. It was hard to get, and you have to keep being persistent and trying.
And you drive. If you got to drive somewhere. Remember in the early days, we had this guy, an older man from the Cape. Do you mm-hmm. remember? Like, quite older. If he was in his 80s, he drove to North Adams, which is as far as you can go in Massachusetts and still be in Massachusetts. Do what you got to do to get the damn shot.
The VA hospitals have them, too. I don't know how hard
if you're
it is
a veteran.
To get them there. You have to be a veteran, right? But if people don't know that, I guess you can get them at the VA. Rudy from Westward, thank you for calling.
Hey, Rudy.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I just have a different outlook from what you're saying. I've had chronic asthma since I was 4 years old. I carry my inhaler with me, mm-hmm. and I get my flu shot every year. And in the short time that I've been getting the flu shot, I mean, I'm 36. It hasn't been a short time. My doctor almost tells me it may not fully cover me this year. I may need to get another one in 6 months. It mm-hmm. used to be once a year. But what I'm saying is the way that you're pushing for the vaccine, it just seems to be like get your vaccine and then go back in your bubble. I don't really see that it should be like that. I think we should have some precautions, absolutely. The people who work in the food industry, I love seeing them wear masks and hairnets. I'm all for it. But it just seems to be like as far as a family get-togethers, I don't think everybody should be tested. Do you avoid people who don't get their flu shot?
Well, I think this is much different. I think we know, Rudy, now that this is much different than the flu. But I think in your family, I mean, I think a lot of people just were together over Thanksgiving.
Well, if everybody's vaccinated at both ends.
Yeah.
I'm not talking, if that's your point, Rudy, if everybody in your family is vaccinated, you're going to another family or friend gathering where everybody's vaccinated, that's fine. But often you don't know and you're not in a position to ask questions. Having said that, I am totally of the school that you belong to, is you can't be a shut-in after 20 months for the rest of your life. You got to start living your life. And as a result, you need precautions, which means maximum vaccinations. And I think in most but not all cases, you do tests, assuming you can afford them and they're available.
And Rudy,
thanks
I'm with you with the hairnets, too. There's nothing worse than finding a little hair in your food.
Yeah, but they had to do that like at the deli counter. They were doing that forever, long before COVID, you know?
Oh, that's right. It's nothing to do with COVID. I just was agreeing with Rudy that I like the fact that...
I got a Band-Aid and a falafel once from a place in Central Square. Is that horrible? That's worse than... Oh, Marjorie can't even talk now.
Oh,
I shouldn't have brought
God.
That up. It was a clean Band-Aid, but nevertheless, it was right in the middle of falafel. I didn't have a falafel for 10 years. We're done for
this.
Oh,
we're done.
Yes.
Oh, okay. We are done. Okay, we're moving on. Coming up, we're going to talk to personal financial columnist Michelle Singletary. She'll help us navigate the holiday shopping season. She's got so much great information that I must admit I was ignorant about, but not anymore. Michelle Singletary is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Online shopping will soar this holiday season. So will scams. That's how personal finance columnist Michelle Singletary's latest column starts. She's here now to help us protect ourselves when shopping online, like on Cyber Monday today and beyond. Michelle, great to talk to you. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I hope you both had a great Thanksgiving.
We did.
We did
and
have
you,
a great Thanksgiving. But you know, it's Cyber Monday, and I'm going to panic now about everything I'm doing wrong about my online shopping. So you're here to straighten us all out to avoid all these scams, Michelle Singletary. Tell us, it's the big day. Well, one of the big days between now and Christmas. But what should we do to avoid these scams?
Well, one thing is just be very careful about anything that you get through texts or emails. I don't know about your email box, but mine is inundated with all kinds of offers for discounts. And they're like, oh, you could get this Amazon $50 gift card. And the majority are just scams or just phishing attempts to get my personal information. So I delete them all, even from companies that I regularly deal with and order from, which look pretty legitimate and probably are. I still go out of my email box and go to the retailer site themselves to look for those deals that they're offering me.
Before you leave that, though, I hate to disagree with you right off the bat. I got a Rolex last week for $12. I mean, who can pass that up, Michelle?
So, I know, right?
Okay, so I have a lot of questions about this. If you get texts, like there are places I've bought stuff from, Frontgate, I bought some towels from them. They send me texts all the time about deals. Is the same thing true?
Wait a second, Michelle is saying it may not be they is the point.
Right, well, that's why I'm asking her. So
that's exactly right. So I do too. I sign up for text mail deals for retailers that I frequent with, and that's fine. You are a loyalty member, and they send it out. So rather than click on the text message, I go to their site, and the deals are on their site. And if you have an account set up, you can go in, and the deals will be displayed within your account. Because the problem is that you aren't always 100% sure that text message comes from that retailer.
Okay.
The scammers are very good at mimicking what might look like a legitimate text message. So just to be on the safe side, I mean, I've gotten to the point where I know which ones are real. But for many, many people, they really don't. And so I just say have a blanket policy. And this is what I tell all my friends and family who are always asking me about different, is this a scam, this is a scam. Have a blanket policy. Don't click on any link that you get from a text message or an email. You know, you see something from a retailer, you say, oh, okay, great. Jump out of your email box, go to that site that you've probably bookmarked, and any deal that they're offering is going to be on their site. And if it's, you know, a code or something, you can print it out and take it to the retailer. I'm just trying to help those folks who are not used to this. And so it's like a blanket policy to help many people who you know, this holiday season maybe for the first time, or maybe last year was the first time, and now this year are shopping online, and just you can't tell the fake from the real.
Okay, you also say, Michelle Singletary, that we should pay with credit cards, not a debit card. So tell us why, and also, is this in general or just during this holiday scammerom season?
So in general, when you're shopping online, I would use a credit card. Now, for me, you guys know how I am. I'm like, no debt, no debt, no debt. And so it pains me to say this for many people because, you know, not using your debit card can keep you out of debt. But when it comes to online shopping, and especially when you're making huge purchases like a big TV or computer, you get a lot more protections with the credit card, consumer protections. For example, if someone steals your card and they charge of things, the law says you're only obligated for unauthorized charges is up to $50. Most retailers won't even, credit card companies won't even charge you that. They say, forget that. You know, we're not going to charge you that. But if you use your debit card, which people want to use because they feel like this will keep them in check, if someone doesn't deliver the product or it's a scam, they have direct access to your banking account. You don't want that. You don't want unauthorized charges because what will end up happiness. If you don't catch them soon enough, you might actually lose that money. There's a small window which you have to tell your bank, hey, this is wrong. And then if someone charges something and say they don't deliver it or what they deliver is that $12 Rolex, right? You've got to argue with the bank to get your money back, and they've got to do an investigation. And let's say they, you know, it was supposed to be a $12 Rolex, but it ended up taking out $1,200. Now you've got your, you know, you've got your mortgage isn't being paid, other bills that are coming through, and they can really mess up your banking account. So you don't want to use your debit card, certainly not one connected to your household banking account. If you want to use a debit card, get a prepaid loaded debit card. So you know you're going to spend $200 for Christmas. You load it up onto that card only that's not connected to your bank account, and then use that debit card to make purchases online. That way your liability is limited to just that card, and they don't have access to your bank account.
Michelle Singletary, you say in this thing that you show in your column, you show an infinitesimally small percentage of people who are buying stuff online during the holidays, you know, X number of years ago, and it's now over 50%. What percent of, do you have any idea what percent of people use credit cards for purchases rather than debit cards? Do you know?
Well, yeah. I don't know the exact number, but online, the majority of people either use a debit or credit card. It's much easier. You know, you can't, you know, send cash through, you know, now people use Cash App, so.
No, I meant credit card versus debit card. I'm sorry, I wasn't clear. Do
yeah,
you know?
No. Yeah, so the majority of people do use credit cards, but there's, you know, when you're younger, the younger crowd, younger adults are more likely to use a debit card because, yeah. A, they haven't qualified for a credit card yet, and they are becoming quite smart at this. They understand that they don't want to charge up the credit card. So younger adults are more likely to use a debit card.
We're talking to Michelle Singletary. So, Michelle, you did another column on how to beat inflation and empty shelves during the holidays. And I have to say, you don't know this, but every year, one of our Christmas shows, Marjorie and I, for the 20 years we've been on the air, is about regifting. And I thought Marjorie had set the all-time record when she gave back the next day a gift that her best friend had given her the day before to her best friend, the exact same person.
It was very embarrassing.
But you may have outpaced Marjorie Egan with your young children when they were young. Can you describe what you did, Michelle Singletary?
Well, first of all, I'm a huge advocate for regifting, but you do have to label them.
You do.
Give it back to the person who gave it to you.
Careful.
Or at least let a couple years go by, then they won't remember, right?
Yeah.
So what I used to do, I have three children. They're now in their early 20s and mid-20s. And so, but when they were little, five or under, the thing about Christmas that they love, the joy, is that all these packages, and they love, like, ripping them over. It's, you know, a surprise inside. And so oftentimes it's really that they're looking forward to. And I kind of got it after the first kid. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I don't have to actually buy a bunch of stuff. Because, you know, through the years, people give your kids, you have a birthday party, they get all the stuff. And I usually take about half of it and store it away anyway. And so, you know, if you've got a kid in the house, you've got a toy bin or they've got a room with things, and they don't play with all that stuff. They have their favorite things that they play with. Those are the things that are at the top of the box, the toy bin. So you take that layer off, the top layer, and then you dig down and all the stuff that they've never seen. And you know, it's all got dust on it. So you dust them off. You put them in a package. You put it on the tree. They open up. Oh, look at this, mommy. And you're like, yay. It works. I'm telling you, it works. Now, when it doesn't work is when the oldest child snitches on you, right? Because my oldest started to snitch on me. She was old enough to go, wait a minute, mommy, that teddy bear was in my brother's room. And so then the other kids kind of turn around and look at you, and then you know that the ruse is over and you can't do that anymore. But you've got a good 5 years before they catch on.
That is a brilliant idea, Michelle. You know what I want to know, too? What about Secret Santa? How do you negotiate that in the family? I mean, was it your idea to do a Secret Santa where you, that's where you draw names just by one gift, right?
Absolutely. So we have a large family. Even my immediate family is a family of five, my husband, myself, and my three kids. Then I've got my sister and my nephew and his wife and my niece. And so it got to be at Christmas time. We were all like exhausted trying to figure out what to get and keep in the budget. And so one Christmas, after Christmas dinner, we were all like, yeah, this is not going to be working for all of us. And then all my kids were in college and they were like, yeah, we don't have all this money to buy for Aunt Monique and, you know, all our other relatives. So we decided to do a Secret Santa within our family group, which could be as many as 13 to 15 people. And so you can see that's a lot of gifts. And so now we do Secret Santa. I found a website that I love called Elfster, like Elf. And so I, you know, literally it's so interesting because I didn't plan it this way, but I set it up this morning just before our call. I sent out all the emails to all the family members. We set a dollar limit per person. So if you pick some money, you can only spend, you know, up to $50. And then we also asked you, you can create a wish list. So if they're college students, we make sure we say, okay, listen, the limit is 50, but you know these kids are in college. So pick something on your list that's like, you know, $10 or $20. And then you have a wish list and we send it out. You get a random, you know, we all get random names. I don't even know who everybody picks. And then we put in a wish list of what you want. And it's so, the website is so cool because you can actually put in links to the stuff where it is and makes it much easier to purchase. And it, we love it. And so now each of us only has to buy one gift in the family group. Nobody feels any, you know, kind of way about it. And we have a ton of fun. And then to your regifting story, Margie, so as a part of the fun, because, you know, you want to get more gifts, so we have everybody bring a white elephant gift. So that's a gift that you've gotten that you didn't really like. It's a nice gift. It's new. And then we play a game with those. So you get to pick them and somebody gets to steal it. And it's so much fun. Because somebody always brings something that they didn't like, but that's really cool, right? So then we're all fighting to try to get it in the game. It's just really fun.
By the way, I went to Elfster. This is great because you're calm. I never heard of this thing. Apparently, mm-hmm. 20 million people are using it. Not only can you make a wish list, there's a link to share so your people in your group can do that. You can also create a gift exchange so they don't even have to buy stuff. They can just, I assume, list things that they have that you might want or that sort of thing. So it's sort of like a re-gifting thing online, no?
Yeah, it's great.
It's great.
We love it, and we do it after Thanksgiving every year now. We've done it for about 3 years now. It takes the pressure off, and if there are some folks who are not coming for dinner, we make sure that we do it in time that that gift gets to be mailed, and then that person's on the phone when we do the gift exchange, and so they get to open it while we're all listening. And we actually even made another game, so we get to you try to guess who gave you the gift, and you don't really have anything to base it on, but it's just like, oh, I got, you know, Tom this year. And so, and then you get a little, you know, I get something at the dollar store or something, and you get a little gift that you guess right. And so we, you know, you see how we have made it fun about the exchange. It's not about the volume of gifts or the number of gifts or the dollar amount. And it makes things so much easier, especially if you're from a large family.
We're talking to Michelle Singletary. She is a nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post on personal finance. So I wonder if you have tips. You mentioned a bunch of times staying within your Christmas budget, which I have never done, and that's probably very bad. What are the tips for how you come up with your budget?
So one of the things you have to do is reduce your gift list. So over the years, you've added people. One year they gave you something, so you added them to the list. And so now you've got this long list of people you feel obligated to give a gift to. So pare that list down. And then secondly, manage people's expectations. If you've lost your job during the pandemic or your income has been disrupted or you say, listen, I just can't afford this. I'm trying to pay down debt. You just let people know. Let them know now before the expectation of the holiday and you're going to be coming over with a bunch of gifts. And especially the adults in your life, just say, you know, we're not going to be on this gift train anymore. We just can't afford it. We've got other financial obligations. We're trying to save more. And I think you'll be surprised at how many people will be relieved that they now can take you off of their gift list. Now, when it comes to the children, it's a little bit, you know, more delicate, because especially, you know, smaller children. Teenagers, actually, you know, we don't give them enough credit for understanding that things might be a little tight.
Right.
And so even for them, you can say, hey, mom and dad, it's tough for us. So is it okay if we do this year? Or do, you know, you could do the Secret Santa, or just say, we'll only be able to give you, you know, one gift. And, you know, I used to have my kids give me a list. And even though we could afford it, I was like, okay, so you're not getting all this on this. I'm going to just tell you right now, Santa is on, you know, holiday, and he cannot get, you know, we would just tell him, and they would, it's so funny, they'd give us a list that was like 2 pages long for the first year. Then after that, it got to be 1 page, because I would go through going, nope, 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 oh, you are crazy. This is not happening, you know.
So,
and it actually became kind of fun, because they were like trying to guess what we would actually agree to on their list.
So, Michelle Singletary, every year, Jim Brody makes me feel like a big cheapskate, because I don't chase the sanitation workers down the street with a $20 bill as a tip for Christmas, and the postman, and the school teachers, and your hairdresser, and all these people.
You don't
that,
tip your mail deliverer?
Well, again, I'm asking Michelle Singletary, the personal finance columnist, about this question, or, you know, give your somebody double your daycare person or your nanny or whatever, your babysitter, twice the weekly pay. This becomes extremely expensive. How do you handle the holiday tipping stuff?
Yeah, well, for government workers, you're not supposed to give them money anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to be careful about that. But you've got to be financially authentic to yourself. And there are some people who can't afford to do all of that. And that's fine that they do. But if you can't, you know, find the few people in your life that has made your life a joy for the year, that they came through for you at some crucial moments, and then give what you can afford.
Yeah.
I think most people who understand this, you know, if it's your hairdresser or the babysitter, you know, you say, I wish I could give you more, but this is just a little appreciation. And lead in with that. And if it's just $20 or $10, you do that. I think that everyone has to live within their means, even within their generosity. And so you can push yourself if you have it. Please do. You know, the your hairdresser, the people who watch your children, the daycare workers, all those people who are not getting paid very much. If you can push it by, say, cutting from other parts of your life where people have everything they need and don't need another watch or scarf, you know, take that money and give it to someone. You know, the waitress at the cafe that you visit every morning, you know, give to the people who are in need, and then just give what you can afford. And that may mean cutting the list down. I think everyone, I know I would appreciate when people can and cannot give, and just be true to yourself.
By the way, you said the criterion should be, you know, think about those who brought joy to your life. So should Marjorie drop $20 on me, or what should she? Is that pretty much, I guess, what you're suggesting? And I thank you for that recommendation. So we're talking
about... You know, it's interesting you should say that, Jim, because here's the other thing that we need to give to people that is so precious, which is our time.
That's
clearly
right.
You guys have a wonderful relationship. So you could just say, hey, let's just, you know, go out for coffee or just a talk or just something not related to the station or your work. And if it's like my sister is now my best friend, and so all she ever says is, I want a sister date. And all that entails is just me coming over and us watching some crazy show or binge watching something. It doesn't have anything to do with, you know, buying something. Just think about, we learned this from COVID when we were all shut in, and we might be shut in again now with the new variant. We wanted to just spend time with people. We wanted to wrap our arms around them. Remember that this year, and remember it in years to come as things open up, that the thing that is the most precious that you can't get back or duplicate or multiply is time.
I'd prefer the $20, but I understand what you're saying. So, Michelle, no, I mean, it's a beautiful sentiment, but, and I, in the abstract, Michelle, we only have a couple minutes left, but, you know, you call it America, the Great Resignation. We actually have a thing here, a series called The Big Quit. And you're talking about people, not just people who leave their job to go to another one, but people who decide to retire. And did I read the number right from your column that 50% of people over 55, was that what the number was? Have retired?
Yeah, they sure did. They got this year.
A ton of them have to be making huge mistakes, meaning not, I mean, most people I know couldn't retire at 55 years old and make it. So what are you telling those folks?
So, you know, what I always tell people is run your numbers. I get why people are saying, listen, I hate the commute. I don't like my job. My boss is like a bear, you know, not in a good way. And I, you know, life is too short, and I want to do something else in the second season of my life. But I always caution people before you quit to run your numbers. Look at what you're going to be living on in retirement. What do you have access to? So if you retire before 65, how are you going to cover health care? What are you getting from Social Security? Because you know you can't collect until 62. So what are you going to live on? What are your expenses? Lots of times people think a lot of their expenses will be reduced once they stop working. You still got a mortgage, you still got rent, you got to buy food, you still have insurance. You know, there are all kinds of things that are still on your budget, even if you're not working full time. So run your numbers. I know that you're tired, you hate your job, you know, but you want to be sure that you're smart about it. And then some people find out they can't afford to retire. They have done well with putting money in their 401k. And actually, you know, we always think about you can't tap your retirement until you're 59 and a half. If you are separated from your job after 55, you actually can tap your retirement account without that 10% penalty. You still have to pay taxes, but you don't have that 10% early retirement penalty if you leave your job. So there is a way for you to access that money earlier. But I would just please, there are all kinds of early retirement calculators online that you can put in your information, and it will spit out whether or not you actually can afford to retire. And if you can't, maybe you quit the current job and get another job or get a part-time job to make things work. But you've got to look at all of those things. And, of course, if you retire early, that means less money going into Social Security, which means a, you know, smaller check when you do retire. So take all those kinds of things in consideration before you quit.
Michelle, as always, it's a joy to talk to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you both.
I feel liberated now for this Christmas season. Thank you very much.
How do you love the story with her and her young kids?
Yeah,
is that the best?
It's the best.
I love that. Just love it.
Michelle, talk soon.
Okay, great.
Great, thank you. Michelle Singletary is a personal finance columnist for the Washington Post, where she writes the nationally syndicated Color of Money column, which runs in the Boston Globe. Thanks again to Michelle Singletary. Coming up, Boston Globe travel writer Christopher Muther joins us. He's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, the emergence of a new COVID variant over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend called the safety of airline travel back into question. Right in time for the biggest spike in travel since before the pandemic. We'll have Christopher Muther, travel writer for the Boston Globe, on to tell us all we need to know. Then it's Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker joining us in studio to talk about where the state stands on the Omicron variant, vaccinations, and why he's dropping his support for major climate legislation that he championed to go in a different direction entirely.
Then the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price discuss the legacy of the late Phil Saviano, who stands against child abuse in the Catholic Church brought the issue to the international spotlight. And Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, joins us to detail this season's holiday pops, as well as the significance of the American musical titan Stephen Sondheim, who was died at age 91. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Howdy, I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Logan, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. As we speak, Joe Biden is delivering remarks on Omicron. Just to give you an update, as he's speaking, he praised South African scientists for identifying and letting the world know about the variant. He said that restricting travels from countries in Southern Africa gives us time to take more action, obviously pushing the vaccine. And boosters, saying that sooner or later we're going to see cases of the new variant in the U.S. And he says it's, quote, cause for concern. not a cause for panic. We'll continue to bring you updates on what the president has to say, and I'm sure the governor will have quite a bit to say when he joins us at 12:30. But first, joining us after this new COVID variant may be threatening travel plans, but at least here in New England, we can escape to the woods, at least according to our guest. Travel writer Christopher Muther is here to talk about how that may have gotten a lot easier as the stock of tiny homes for rent is on the rise. Christopher Muther, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure is all mine. Thank you, Jim.
Hey, Christopher, great to talk to you. So let's start with this Omicron variant. The Washington Post is asking the question that many others are, too. It's being detected in more places all around the world. So are these travel bans too little, too late?
You know, I am not a scientist, despite the fact that I barely passed intro biology my freshman year of college. But I will say that, you know, just based on what we've seen before, it's definitely too little, too late. I think the chances of the new variant already being in the United States are probably about 110%, given that it's been found to be in Canada and the UK and all these other countries, which are now kind of open for travel to the United States. And when you think back on historically travel bans and, you know, our travel ban to and from China, back in early 2020, and we both know how effective that was, and it wasn't effective. But, you know, as Dr. Fauci has said, you know, any time we can buy is good, because it just seems like there's so much unknown about this variant. All I can think is I'm trying to stay positive, I guess is what I'm saying in a very flustered and roundabout way.
Are airline executives trying to stay positive? I assume after, we're going to talk to you about it in a minute, after the huge uptick, which is an understatement, in flights by people over the Thanksgiving weekend, I assume fears like this cause numbers to drop precipitously in terms of people who are doing airline travel, no?
It's, again, much like the variant itself, it's hard to know how things are going to play out with this. I think a lot of people have already made their winter travel plans, you know, their school holiday plans. So it's tough to know if we'll see the kind of big cancellation numbers that we saw, you know, back in the spring of 2020, which, as you know, at that point, airlines just tanked, as did the hotel industry and those things. So everyone is watching. The timing of it is so interesting, because right now, as you know, it's Cyber Monday. Tomorrow is something referred to as Travel Tuesday, which is when there's like all these really great deals on travel. You know, a lot of airline deals, a lot of hotel deals.
And Wednesday is We Are Doomed Wednesday, by the way. That is, I don't know if you're aware, but gosh.
And Thursday is Christopher Muther is in a bunker day. But that's another story altogether. But yeah, so, you know, I think this might be a good indication of how consumers are feeling, at least depending on the numbers that we see of tickets purchased through today and tomorrow. But as you also remember, airlines really have adapted their cancellation policy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Is it now with no penalty on most major airlines if you do cancel, or only if you cancel because of COVID? I mean, what's the policy?
Policy on most of them is that if you buy the super cheap basic economy seats, you cannot get a refund on your seats. And when I say refund, I mean most of them are offering future travel and within a year or two. So if you are going to book travel and you're at all remotely leery about it, then you should read all the fine print on that. But yeah, for the most part, airlines are being super flexible because they know they have to. There's not much of a choice.
Talking to Christopher Muther, travel writer for the Boston Globe.
So, Christopher, you have advised us that we need to be very patient this year if we are going to the airport. Terminal C, you said, the queue for the baggage drop resembled a conga line from hell. Every self-check-in kiosk was occupied. The line for security was akin to people crowding for a lifeboat on the Titanic. So it's not
He's laughing at his own writing, by the way.
That's sorry, it's so good. I can't help it.
It's not an encouraging report, I guess, unless you get your TSA PreCheck.
Yeah, TSA PreCheck, I think, is pretty essential. And as Jim mentioned, you know, the numbers of people traveling this year for Thanksgiving were essentially more than double of last year, which isn't a surprise. But people are feeling more emboldened because of the vaccines, which is great. But on the other hand, I think we all fell into a mindset, anyone who did travel through kind of the past year or so when things were relatively quiet, that, you know, it's also going to be fairly quiet through the holidays. And I'm here to tell you that it is not. You know, it's really important to get to the airport early, make sure that you are set in terms of documentation of where you're going. For instance, if you're traveling outside of the country, make sure you know all of those restrictions and have all of the proper tests and copies of your vaccination card before you go. But yes, when you're at the airport itself, it's pretty important to prepare yourself emotionally and physically for the hell you will probably go through.
You know, but this pre-check deal that Marjorie mentioned a minute ago, I remember, I mean, ages ago when I first moved here, I was flying all the time back and forth in New York. Even when I was traveling less pre-pandemic, but flying, you know, several times a year, I automatically ended up on the pre-check list, even though I didn't apply for it. I don't know what that was about. But right now, how does someone get on the pre-check list? And was the point you and Marjorie making that if you're on the pre-check list,
it's better?
It is much better. So how do you get on it? What do you do if you're not automatically plopped on it, Christopher Muther?
Yeah. I think you're slightly confused, Jim. You were on the do not fly list, not the pre-check list.
That may have been it. That's right. How do you get on it?
Tomato, tomato. It's, you know, it's something you apply for. So you go to the TSA website, okay. You apply, it's $85. It lasts for, I think pre-check is 4 or 5 years. If you do global entry, then pre-check is included in that. Global entry hasn't been obviously as much of a priority for a lot of folks lately, but I would say TSA pre-check, yes. And it usually doesn't take too long to process. And, you know, like I said, go to the TSA website. There's a link there. You can apply for pre-check. And when you get to the airport, you'll see the regular security line and the pre-check line. And, you know, the regular security line is sort of like, you know, Black Friday circa 2018. Yeah. Whereas pre-check is, you know, most of the time you can breeze right through.
That's fab. You know, it's almost like you had companion stories, though. I'm embarrassed to say I thought Worcester Regional Airport was no more until I read your story. And I know there have been some highs and lows. But the solution to overcrowding at Logan is obviously Worcester. And when I was mentioning it to a friend this weekend, they were saying, oh, it's so far away. Most people are not in this country are not lucky enough to live 10 minutes from an airport. The airport is usually an hour drive, as you know, from a city. So Worcester is no farther from Boston than most airports are in most major urban areas. How serious is the rejuvenation of Worcester Regional, and what's flying out of there and what is going to be flying out of there?
It's pretty serious in terms of Massport having sunk a fair amount of money into it. One of the big points that one of the big issues airlines had with Worcester Regional was the elevation. And the elevation of it means that it gets some of the worst weather. It gets fogged in, it gets icy, and it's hard for planes to land. And they've installed a new radar system so planes can come in and essentially it's a Category 3 landing system, and it enables flights to land in low visibility, which is, you know, a bit of a godsend for Worcester Regional, and hopefully they're hoping more airlines will come. But the issue is that it's sort of like a, you know, if they build it, they'll come, but will they come if they've built it? So JetBlue, Delta, and American Airlines all fly out of Worcester Regional, but on a very sort of limited schedule. And, you know, JetBlue goes to Florida, And they also go to JFK. A few of them go to JFK. One goes to Philadelphia. So it's fairly limited in where they go. And, you know, that's part of the problem of Worcester Regional getting back. But you raise an interesting point in that most urban airports are not located in the city.
Of course.
I mean, we are so spoiled in Boston. I think about Pearson in Toronto, and it's takes forever to get there from the city. So Worcester Regional isn't terrible, but it's also one huge.
Sounds great. But by the way, didn't you say free parking, which is huge? Is that what did you write that free parking at Worcester?
Yeah, I mean, until the end of the year, it's free parking. And other than that, it's like $7 a day.
That's
so
great. That's great.
Even if you're driving out there, the savings end up kind of balancing out in terms of, you know, the pain that you might incur from driving out to Worcester.
Well, you know what I wonder? How do we fare? I would imagine Logan obviously is a huge draw, but you mentioned in your story, you know, Worcester wanted to compete with TF Green and Providence. If that's not a bad drive, and it's the parking is so easy, everything's so easy at Green, how much of a draw do they take from Logan? Much at all?
Pretty from Logan. I'd say not too much, yeah. Only because of the selection of airlines. You know, Logan, when it comes to international travel,
right.
It's kind of in New England, that's where it's at. The domestic routes also, you know, there's a lot more options. So TF Green is, you know, it was traditionally kind of the home of where bargain airlines flew out of.
Yep.
And some of them are still doing that. But, you know, they also have American and JetBlue. Also unlimited routes, but I feel like even people from that area are still driving to Logan.
Okay, so let's get to, I love this story about these teeny tiny houses up in New Hampshire. The company's like taking off big time. Tell us what they are and what's happening.
Yeah, it's really funny because a few years ago, there is this sort of Harvard Innovation Lab company that started, it's called Getaway House. And the idea is that it's a tiny house and you go there to unplug and be a part of nature and all of that. And at the time it arrived, pretty much all of my colleagues decided they were travel writers and they decided to go up and write stories before I had a chance. As you can imagine, people are always trying to steal my job at the Globe. And so this was if people decided they were going to do this. And so I didn't really pay too much attention to it. And then I heard that they were opening, Getaway House was opening a new Connecticut location. Meanwhile, in New Hampshire, what started as 3 tiny houses had grown to 43. And the company has, you know, they're all over the country now. It's kind of crazy how it's taken off. So, yeah, there's a new Getaway House opening in Connecticut. There's the New Hampshire location. And at long last, I'm going to claim travel supremacy, and I'm going to stay at one of the new locations before my colleagues do.
Where are you going?
I'm probably going to do New Hampshire first.
So, by the way, these are, according to you, or I guess according to the company, through you, 140 square feet for 2 people, 200 square feet for 4 people. They shouldn't call it Getaway House. They should call it Guantanamo House, as far as I'm concerned. But the only thing, and you have an option to check your cell phone.
The windows next to the bed.
The window is the best part. They say no matter how many houses there are, there's a whole wall of a window that always only is off nature as opposed to another house. That's sort of, well, you haven't done it. Why am I asking you? It's sort of, but that's an appealing kind of thing. And who are the people who do this other than your Globe? I mean, this is really small space, Christopher Muther.
It is. And I'm going to go ahead and say that it's probably primarily millennials who want to put it on Instagram because it's sort of like it's a getaway house where you're supposed to unplug, but I have a feeling there's a lot of influencers with their phone there taking a lot of pictures and running through it. So it might sort of defeat the purpose of unplugging, but I have a feeling, you know, there's also The Airstream Hotel, which I stayed at on the Cape.
Oh, yes. We talked about that. That seemed pretty. That's like having a, like a house, though, a pretty house, like in a, on a spot, right?
It is. It is definitely much larger than Getaway House, but it's also, you know, something that's very Instagrammable, and that's, you know, another upside of it. However, Getaway House is intended for folks who want to put their phone away. The house has a lockbox in it for your phone. You, it's self-policed, of course, but
oh my God,
if you want to have the illusion of putting your phone away, you put your phone away. There's no Wi-Fi. There's no TV. Of course, there's no room for those things in the tiny house, but that's beside the point. The idea is you are in nature, you're part of nature, but you also get like a cute little retro refrigerator in your cabin.
How much does this cost, by the way? Well, how much does this cost? By the way, I did the math. If you're staying with three other people in a 200 square feet house, it's each of you have 7 feet by 7 feet. Literally, that's what you have. You have 49 square feet each. Wait a second. How much does it cost?
I mean, it depends on location and time of year, but the range is about $250 to $420.
A night?
A night, yes.
You know what?
Wait, and you think that's nothing, Marjorie? You think that's cheap?
Well,
for a little box,
I thought it was $169 a night. Did I read it wrong? I thought it was $169, which seems pretty good.
Well, go ahead. Okay.
But anyway, here's what I was wondering, Christopher Muther. Though, they've got these beds in front of this huge wall of a window, and you talk about how there are a lot more of these tiny houses everywhere. I hope there's a shade on this window. Is there?
That's a really good question.
Because you know, you might be wondering, it would be great to look out that window, but your neighbor might be looking in when you're looking out, and oh my goodness, you know.
Well, for some of us who like to put on a show, I'd prefer there be no shade. You know, my pasties come out every once in a while.
And really, I don't.
Put on a show.
I heard you. Put on a show, yeah.
You can dance on the bed right in front of the window.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Jump on the bed and you have fun.
Right.
No, there is a shade for those who want to sleep in or have a little bit of privacy.
When are you doing this, by the way?
I can't really say because I don't want them to know.
Oh,
however,
okay.
I'll do it. I'll probably do it sometime this winter in New Hampshire because I want to be able to watch the snow and look at the woodland creatures frolic outside, and they can watch me frolic inside. So everyone's happy.
You know, I made a mistake. It was the Connecticut location that was $169.
Right. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. That is like an introductory fare that they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But did you mention the fire pits outside, too?
No.
That's kind of a neat little feature, too, right? These nice fire pits.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a really – for those of us who live in the city, it's kind of like a nice way to get outside a little bit.
Yeah. Although now I'm reading about the other fire pits, with the ones that – the smokeless fire pits – which sound like the way to go.
No, what is it? What's with that?
They're a brand of fire pit which you can buy that doesn't supposedly have any smoke.
No, can I tell you, the only thing, I love this concept, and it's sort of like, how much does it cost again in Connecticut?
$169, the introductory thing.
And it's exactly the same, but a lot cheaper than a casket. It's the exact same size. And so it's really, now, Chris Muther, before you leave, I want to play something for you, and Marjorie and I would like to get your reaction, if you don't mind. So stay tuned. Here it is.
All right.
Yeah, keep this going for a little while, if you would.
Oh, yeah. I'm on it.
Okay.
I'm also dancing with my cat right now.
Okay, that's enough. That's more than enough. That, of course, well, what is that? You tell us what that is, please.
That is ABBA singing Just an Ocean. Is it Just an Ocean?
No,
from
Don't Shut Me Down, but it's
from their first album in 40 years called A Voyage.
Now, there is word on the street that you are an ABBA fan, which I really – by the way, what's the name of that great movie that ABBA's music is featured in? Mamma Mia is absolutely fabulous. But ABBA, I mean, are you really – I couldn't tell if you were serious. Are you an ABBA fan or you're not?
Oh, I'm an ABBA fan.
And what is what is that about? What is that?
I'm
about?
Not a fan of Mamma Mia, but I'm a fan of ABBA for
and
sure.
And why is that, Chris Vermuther?
When you listen to their songs and the hooks in the songs, it's like it just grabs you. It tears your flesh out. These hooks are so good. The studio artistry of it all, you know, people will think, oh, Dancing Queen,
yeah,
wedding song. But when you go beyond Dancing Queen and Take a Chance on Me, which are still wonderful songs,
sure,
there's so much there to discover. And,
really?
Yes. And then there's the solo album.
What is there there to discover? If you can share that with us, please.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when Bjorn and Benny first started recording these songs, they recorded them like in a swimming pool to get sort of like an empty swimming pool to get the effect, the echoey effect that you hear. 8 tracks, 16 tracks.
They were just, know that. You know,
they were pioneers in what they were doing. And they were also just amazing songwriters.
Okay.
Now, can we put this in context before we bid you adieu? Have you seen any of Get Back yet?
Oh, I haven't, but I'm dying to.
Well, I watched the first 2 hours the other night, and is really. Have you seen it yet, Mark?
No, I have not.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the most unbelievable thing is they're sitting around in this warehouse, essentially, the four of them. It's really great because it is really intimate. It's a Beatles thing. I forgot for those who don't know. Peter Jackson made it. And the four of them are sitting around in a circle, just brainstorming, whatever. Who's the fifth person who just sits there and does stuff through the whole deal?
Maybe Bernie or Benny without from ABBA? Saying
Yoko Ono. Oh, it's Yoko just sitting Ono. There. But in any case, just to see what your credentials are, I know ABBA's the greatest. It's a deep. How would you compare ABBA and the Beatles? How would you do that, Chris Vermuther?
Oh, geez. Well, I mean, they're both quartets. Yeah.
Okay, I was afraid of. Okay.
Let me just throw in something very quickly, if it's important for readers to know about. Yeah. I mean, listeners.
Yeah.
I'm so in a brain of newspapers. Yeah. Listeners to know about, which is in Get Back, which I haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm.
There is one scene where you probably remember this, Jim, where mm-hmm. Billy Preston comes in
mm-hmm.
and he's kind of jamming along, and they ask him if he wants to stick around and record. And he says, no, I'm going to record with Lulu because she's working on a television special. And so I would just encourage listeners to go and listen to Lulu's catalog, because I, of course, started doing that after. And you'll find that she's, if you're going to put things in a hierarchy, you'll have ABBA, Lulu, and then the Beatles.
Okay. Guess we won't be discussing music with you again.
Well, maybe Adele next time. The new divorce
Her
album.
Sales are not doing so. Well, she's number one, but not anywhere near the last album.
Really?
Hey, Chris Vermuther, it was a joy talking to you as always. Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Christopher. Christopher Vermuther is a travel writer and columnist for the Boston Globe, and we thank him for being here. I'm really interested in these little teeny tiny houses. I think it sounds really
neat.
Would
you do that in all seriousness?
Yes, I would.
For a weekend?
Maybe for one night, just to check it out.
Okay.
Coming up, Governor Charlie Baker joins us in studio. Governor Baker is next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Governor Baker is somewhere in the building here at GBH. It's a big building, though, so he will be with us in a couple of seconds. You know, as we mentioned, Joe Biden was doing his press conference. There's no real news out of the press conference. Again, saying that they're sparing no effort, vaccinations are key, masking as well. Says Fauci thinks vaccines should provide some protection, but also the team is working with vaccination companies on contingency plans. He went out of his way. He also said it's interesting that the problem in South Africa is not the number. They apparently have the vaccines, at least. Well, this is what he said. Joe Biden says South Africa does not need more vaccines. They're having trouble getting them into people's arms. I think I read in the New York Times yesterday the completed vaccination rate for people in South Africa, not Southern Africa, where some of the other countries where there's been a travel ban, but South Africa itself is somewhere in the 25% range. Fauci talks, and I'm just reading, one of our colleagues, Rebecca, watched Joe Biden. Fauci talks about current incoming travel requirements, saying that PCRs can pick it up, and is and says, this is interesting, requiring testing, et cetera, for domestic flights is not recommended, according to the president of the United States. As we finish summarizing what Joe Biden had to say, we now will be joined by somebody else who has something to say about the Omicron variant. That would be the governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. When was the last time we saw, welcome, first of all, when was the last time we saw you?
I don't remember.
Was it pre-pandemic, or did you come in the middle of this?
No, he didn't come in the middle.
No, I think I was here once or twice in the summer.
Okay.
In the spring, maybe.
You look good. You look pretty good. You look pretty much
the same.
Not bad.
We see you every day on TV, Jim. Well, so.
But it's really good to see you, Governor. Thanks
good
for
to see you guys
coming
too.
That's right. And you were probably here in the summer when we were so much more encouraged about COVID.
Everything.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Well, Governor Baker, before we ask you about local things, do you know anything more about this new variant that we should be aware of than what the president said? I mean, you're the governor. I don't know.
Boy, I would hope that what I know is pretty consistent with what they know, since we get a lot of our information about this stuff from them. I think what I said yesterday when I got asked about this is, as I continue to believe, the best thing people can do to protect themselves from any of these variants is get vaccinated if you're not, and get a booster if you're eligible. And if you're eligible in Massachusetts, if you're over the age of 18 and you're 6 months out on your Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 months out on your J&J, I think the two big things that the researchers are looking into at this point, one is how transmissible is this, right? And is it a more virulent strain than the other ones that are out there? Remember, we went through a similar exercise here on Delta where there was a lot of concern about both transmissibility and virulence with Delta. And I think the conclusion most people came to was, yep, more transmissible, but not more virulent. And I think the vaccines that are currently in place turned out to work quite well with respect to Delta. So I understand the concern, but I think people need to recognize and understand that people are chasing this pretty hard. You got folks all over the globe who are chasing data and information, and it'll probably take a few days to figure out what we don't know. But again, the best thing you can do is the stuff we've been preaching and practicing here in Massachusetts for a while.
You know, we got a number of emails this morning from people saying, I know people who said they've had a hard time getting an appointment for a booster. We can talk about that in a second if you know. It's not nearly what it was like getting the initial vaccinations, which obviously was hell. We've been talking here, Governor Baker, for ages, long before this latest variant, about the unaffordability and inaccessibility of home testing, which it seems to me, at least, is a huge plus. When we were talking about it earlier this morning with our listeners, someone from New Hampshire emailed and said that your colleague, Governor Sununu, is now sending tests, free rapid tests, to every household in New Hampshire. Supposedly a million tests are available. Is that something you've been thinking about or contemplating?
Well, I'm not familiar with what they're doing in New Hampshire. I can tell you that the primary – we've been using the rapid tests – in a variety of places and spaces. I agree with you, by the way, about the slow movement on the availability of rapid tests generally in the U.S. And I've raised this on a number of calls with the White House for months. And part of it had to do with the fact that the U.S. treated rapid tests as a medical device and not as a public health measure, and put them through a much more complicated and difficult process than they needed to. At this point in time, the last time we talked with the feds about this, they said there should be as many as 10 or 12 rapid tests either on the market or coming on the market, and the price tag associated with them would drop dramatically. We've been using them in nursing homes and congregate care facilities, in prisons, in schools, and they've been a huge part of our test and stay program in schools, which means, I don't think New Hampshire does either of these things, but we test all the kids for the most part in school every week. And if a kid tests positive, we then test all of their close contacts using the test and stay rapid tests. And if those rapid tests continue to test negative, the kids can continue to go to school. And as a result of that, we've probably saved somewhere around 140,000 school days so far of in-person learning here in Massachusetts, where the kids would have had to quarantine because they were close contacts to another child who tested positive. I think the biggest challenge, look, I would, if I had the test capacity, I would definitely consider distributing them everywhere. The flip side of that is there's a market issue here. In most parts of Western Europe, you can buy these for a buck on a street corner. And we have not reached the point in this country where we have that kind of supply available. I mean, we have to fight for the supply we get currently to run our nursing home test and stay program in schools, our congregate care programs, and our programs for inmates and correctional officers.
But you could, if you could get access to numbers, you'd consider making them available free to people.
Of course. Yeah.
Why do you have to fight for this? Why is it so difficult?
Because the supply is limited.
It's not there. Okay. Who pays for them in schools? Is it the town, the state?
We pay.
The state does. Okay. So all those schools, the hundreds of thousands of tests.
We have 2,000 schools that are participating in this program in Massachusetts.
Okay.
It's the broadest and most significant testing program in the country for kids and staff in schools.
Which we thought
was an important part of keeping people in school, giving them confidence to know what was going on with respect to COVID in schools.
People were also complaining, we were talking about this earlier this morning, about the difficulty getting boosters, saying that they've gone to CVS, Walgreens, that they're, you know, 2 and 3 weeks out on boostersvax.com. Is that going to change, or is that just going to be how it is with
boosters? We're doing somewhere around 55,000 boosters and first and second shots a day, okay?
Wow.
At our peak, we were doing about 80,000 last spring. We're going to continue to see if we can increase capacity. I mean, one of the good news here is about 1 million people in Massachusetts have gotten a booster since the program began. And we have one of the highest vaccination rates in the country for kids over the age of 5 and under the age of 18, which is also good. And we continue to vaccinate kids at a pretty rapid rate for those age quartiles. I think the good news is we had tons of open appointments to get boosters 2 weeks ago. There's been a lot of which is good. I mean, I'm happy to have increases. And we're going to talk to our folks about whether we can come up with additional ones. I will say this. When I hear this from this, probably some of the same people you do, when I go look at VaxFinder at mass.gov, I can always find appointments. Now, they may not be in the place somebody wants to go to get one, and it may be a week or 10 days out or 2 weeks out before they can get one. But given the fact that we have far more demand now than we had a couple weeks ago, we're going to see if we can increase our capacity to do more.
Did you get a booster, brother?
I'm getting one this week.
You are.
So
did you get one?
Yeah.
Good.
I got one about, I would say, maybe 30 seconds after they were made available to my age group, give or take
So this is a good example of this, right? You know, you guys both probably know this. I turned 65 recently. And until recently, unless you were 65, you weren't eligible under the federal guidelines.
Correct.
We changed our guidelines before they changed theirs because, frankly—
Day before, right?
Was it a day before?
I think it was
a couple
day before,
days before.
Yeah, whatever it was.
I mean, bottom line is we kept waiting for them to go there and eventually just said, screw it, and did it. And we were one of maybe four or five states that came out before they did. But bottom line is, if you're over the age of 18 and you're out 6 months, you should be trying to schedule and get one.
How do you think the federal government's doing on vaccinations and all things COVID? I mean, some people think that Joe Biden should have said the airlines should demand vaccinations. Do you think?
And why aren't they providing free tests to everybody in America off those phone calls, just like they provided free vaccines? Why are we?
I don't know why. I mean, if you talk to people in Europe about this, they don't understand the rapid test issue. They really don't in the U.S. I do feel like we have a lot of catching up to do there. And the message we get is that we are going to get there. I hope we get there soon because there is tremendous value in rapid tests that work as both a preventive device and a public health device and as a work and employment device.
And one last thing, this is from an email that wants to know about vaccine passports in Massachusetts.
Yep.
Are we looking at those at all?
The thing we're trying to do, and we've been talking to a lot of other states about it, and you can get it now, depending upon, there's my QR code.
Oh, very good. Very nice.
This is my,
thank you.
This is my proof that I've been vaccinated. It's my proof that I've been vaccinated. It's easy to access. It's a universal standard, and we've been working with a bunch of other states, there's probably 15 or 20 of them, to try to create a single QR code that can be used for all sorts of things where people may choose to require a vaccine.
How close is that deal?
Soon.
Really?
Yeah.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. He'll be with us till the top of the hour, maybe a couple of minutes past the top of the hour. So you had a meeting with the new mayor of Boston, Michelle Wu, to talk about free the tea and talk about rent control. Those are two things.
Well, I wanted to talk about a few things too, but yeah, we talked about a bunch of stuff. I mean, the thing that people may or may not appreciate about the city of Boston and the Commonwealth of Mass is there is always a plethora of activity going on between the city and the state in transportation, in healthcare, in economic development, in housing. I mean, they're the biggest metropolis in Massachusetts, and there's always stuff going on there that relates to us and relates to them. There's a long list of to-dos that are always underway. And when I met with her on the transportation piece, we talked a little bit about the free bus route that we had put in place as a demonstration with then Mayor Janey, which was, I think, the
28.
Yeah. And she wanted to add the 29 and the 23, I think it was, 26.
I think so, yeah.
One or the other, to the program. And I said, sure. I mean, we'll work with you to figure that out. I think the city council's having a hearing on it today.
Yeah.
But those are the kinds of, yeah, sure, happy to help and work on that stuff. I told her what my experience was with rent control back in the day. Which was incredibly negative and incredibly inequitable. And she said that really wasn't the way she was thinking about it. So we'll see where that goes. I said, when someone asked me about this, I said, look, I don't want to close the door on anything that creates more housing people can afford in Massachusetts because Lord knows we need it. And I think you folks know, and we've talked about the fact that we asked the legislature for $1 billion in May to fund our housing agenda, and you know the clock's still ticking and we're still waiting, and you know we have a ton of federal resources to put into this, and we should, separate and apart from anything associated with what happens statutorily.
You know, speaking of legislature, we weren't going to bring this up till later, but since you brought it up, I assume everybody knows that they went onto a 7-week vacation without having come to a deal on this $4 billion in the rescue funds that you've been imploring them to make a decision about for a while. First question is, can you tell the difference when they're on vacation and when they're not? Is that something you're able to detect, Governor? Did you hear the question?
Yeah, I did. No, they continue to have hearings when they're in informal session. The biggest difference is when they're informal session versus informal session, and they're in informal session.
What
now.
Do you think of a seven? We've had this discussion with you through the years. 7-week vacation with this much unfinished business, is that okay with you?
I'm incredibly unhappy about the fact that some of the stuff that people committed to getting done before the Thanksgiving break didn't get done. Okay, I mean the biggest one, of course, is the ARPA issue, but we also had a big billion-dollar surplus that was marbled into all the conversations about ARPA as well at the end of last year, and I think the I would love to think some of this could get done in an informal session. It's just complicated because if one person votes against it and is in the state house at that moment, it can't pass. And it's hard to do conference committee work, and it's hard to do comprehensive and complicated legislation. Then you can do smaller stuff. But
did you ask them to stay? I don't know what the protocol is. I mean, again, they're off for 7 weeks. Do you ask them to stay until they finish the
I asked them that they could try and figure this out during the informal. I did. Yeah.
And what was the answer?
That they would try and work on it. I mean, they are still talking, so we'll see.
But
we filed our bill in May, and a lot of it involved things like workforce development and skill building and job training and apprenticeship programs and rapid reemployment opportunities. That, to me, in May, would have been really helpful to a lot of people who are trying to figure out, now that their industry is no longer what it once was, where they're going to get a job and how they're going to pay their bills. And I feel the same way about some of the other issues as well. A lot of the environmental infrastructure stuff, which isn't sexy and mostly ends up being underground and out of sight, is what keeps people's homes and people's businesses and people's downtowns from flooding during storms, of which we have more all the time. Some of this stuff, I think, was kind of fell into the we should just do it category, and I would really like to get started on it.
Well, you know what? Not to keep dumping on the legislature, but why not? Since I didn't know this was true until Matt Stout wrote about it in the Globe a couple of weeks ago, that the Massachusetts State House is the only State House in the country. I think Hawaii's got some weird thing going on there, too.
You can do tours, I think, in Hawaii.
Yeah, in this continent, we're the only one, including New York, where they had terrible COVID outbreaks. They're shut down. And as Matt Stout's piece points out, this means if you want to go in and harass your legislator or, you know, whatever, with your bring the Boy Scouts and whatever, you can't do it. And there's no clue yet on when they're going to reopen. It's closed. I mean... Do you know why?
They're still in
closed.
Fairness, okay, there is a lot of work that gets done in the district offices. And in some respects, having legislators a little closer to the people that they work for is not a bad thing. And the legislature's done a great job, in my opinion, of leveraging virtual hearings and virtual technology to make it possible for a lot more people to participate for whom travel is a problem or whatever it might be, can't get off work. I mean, there are a lot of people who have been able to participate in hearings who couldn't previously. But that said, I do think the building needs to bustle, needs to be open, needs to give people that sense of, you know, being present with their democracy. And I say that with all due respect to the concerns the legislature has about the fact that it is a public building. It's not like you can't manage it the same way you manage a traditional office building because, you know, once the doors are open, they're pretty much open.
Right.
And But I do think we need to get people back in the building at some point.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, a couple of environmental things. Months ago, we talked to you about this transportation climate initiative that you were big on. I know you've stepped back from it after a bunch of other states stepped out. I'm curious to know what the alternative was, because my understanding is that was one of the critical ways you got to this net zero thing by 2050. And also, after the voters of in a related why are you laughing?
I kind of figured that was going to be the second one.
And the voters of Maine rejected, I think it was 60-40, this transmission line from Quebec, this hydroelectric power thing. And after it was rejected, the premier of Quebec says there's a plan B. That was a month ago. We haven't heard what the plan is. You said something like it's not dead yet. And I know you got a letter from some bipartisan legislators in the last few days saying, please kill this thing. What's the plan B for the TCI, and is there a plan B for the hydroelectric power from Quebec?
Well, on the hydropower piece, there are a series of court cases that are now in process to figure out sort of the legality of a number of the issues associated with this. And as I said at the time, the ballot question was a, you know, retrospective reversal of a decision that had already been made by duly appointed and authorized boards, and people had begun spending money and making investments based on those approvals and that authority. And
so what do you think? It's like an illegal taking or
something? Well, it falls. I mean, if somebody decides they want to build a an affordable housing project, and they get all the approvals they're supposed to get, and then somebody passes and they start building it, and then somebody passes something that says retroactively, you can't do this anymore. It does raise an important legal question, irrespective of the nature of the question or how people voted on it. And I got to tell you that if we're serious about decarbonizing our economy, and if we're committed to creating a future in which there's a lot less reliance on traditional fossil fuels, if we're not willing to do some things with respect to transmission, which has to be a big part. I mean, we basically led the charge on the deep water offshore wind industry, all right? When we, working with the legislature, got that bill passed, put those bids out and got the price back, and everybody looked at it and said, oh my, offshore wind done this way is actually not only better for the environment, it's affordable. All of a sudden, everybody up and down the East Coast got into this game, and instead of talking megawatts, we're talking gigawatts. Well, guess what? To get all those megawatts and gigawatts into the power grid, you have to create transmission capacity. And that transmission capacity, in many cases, is going to require people to issue permits and make decisions. And, I very much want to see this stuff succeed. But it doesn't come without some degree of change in the way we have thought historically about how much power we have in the grid, how it gets there, and how it operates.
But I just want to be clear, other than the potential, which it sounds like you're saying legally there may be, to overturn the decision of the Maine voters, is there a plan B other than that in terms of getting this power from Quebec?
It is possible. There have been some conversations.
Like
with
what?
I'm not going to say.
You don't have to say whatever you comment, but what is the other possible? You won't say what the other possible ways
are. No, because we're still working on them. But
with whom?
CMP, Central Maine Power, and the folks in Quebec.
Okay.
You know, Governor Baker, as long as we're talking about power, let's talk about the proposed power plant in Peabody. Dave Abels described it this way up in the Globe, said it would cost $85 million to build, spew thousands of tons of carbon dioxide and other harmful pollutants into the atmosphere for years, perpetuate reliance on fossil fuels in communities across Massachusetts, all the while this new state law takes effect requiring drastic cuts of greenhouse gas emissions. And he says the state's got to intervene, otherwise this will be going up under construction in the next few weeks. What about this Peabody plant?
So this was a decision that was made by the local and duly elected municipal power company in Peabody many years ago to dramatically reduce their carbon emissions on their existing system. This is a giant improvement over the system they had in place, and that's why the local officials who were elected by their peers voted to do it and continue to support it.
But you're saying even though it's taking the place.
I don't know the answer to the question about if the question you're asking me is, would this require a retroactive removal based on the fact that there was some sort of law change? I don't know the answer to that question. What I can tell you is that this is a giant improvement over the status quo.
But even taking that it's a giant improvement over the status quo, it seems like a weird time to be building these power plants, which are still going to cause emissions
and
pollution.
It's a peak plant. It's basically designed to work only in points of time when you have a peak problem. You may recall the winter of 2015 when we had what I would describe as a peak problem. You know, one of the big problems with power generally is, you know, you build your system to basically deal with those points in time when demand skyrockets, which typically tend to be really hot spells in the summer, really cold spells in the winter. And people create what I would describe as sort of fail-safe mechanisms to make sure that they can continue to deliver power when they hit those things. Now, historically and still, in many places around the Northeast, the answer to that stuff is oil. And oil, as we all know, is by far the worst of the pollutants. This particular, the reason the folks in Peabody went this way was because they were converting an oil-based system to natural gas, which is a huge improvement environmentally.
So you're saying even though it's going to cause pollution, it's going to cause less pollution than what's there now, and so we need to go for that in this interim period before we get rid of all these things?
Well, they still need to make sure they have an answer for how they're going to power their community in peak periods. And this was the answer they landed on. And the folks who made that decision were duly elected to make decisions like that and continue to support them.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, I have an offer you can't refuse. Turn around, look at that mug on the window if you can there. You see that mug with Marjorie's picture? There is me on the other side. If you can answer my next question, he's looking at it right now.
Look at how serious you look there, Jim.
We call it the smug mug. Thank you, Governor. Governor, if you can
answer... Hands crossed always seems to be the key.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. It's arms crossed you're talking about. It's
right, okay. Arms crossed, yeah.
So if you can answer my next question without me asking it, you will get a free Jim and Marjorie smug mug.
I'm sure he can't wait
so
for that.
Can you answer the question without me having asked it? I ask you every month.
No,
that's
it.
That's a hint.
It's coming soon, Jim, I promise.
And what would that be that's coming soon?
The answer.
To what is it again? I'm sorry.
I'm assuming the question you're interested in knowing about is the same one I get asked pretty much.
Every day.
Every day.
Which is
what are the Lieutenant Governor and my plans for 22?
How close are we?
I said soon.
We said soon last month, too.
Yeah.
And it's still soon.
Yeah.
So
when you're 65 years old, soon can cover a lot of territory.
So just staying on this just for 2 seconds here. And last month, I asked you if you'd made up your mind and just weren't telling us yet. And you said no. Have you made up your mind now?
We're getting pretty close.
So you do know what you're doing.
No, I said we're getting pretty close.
Okay. And lastly on this thing is a poll was done, admittedly, by a consultant, a Democratic consultant, that said that you would fare far better should you run, if you were to run as an independent, that actually you'd potentially be crushed by Jeff Diehl in a Republican primary because this is a Trumpian Republican rank and file in the state, I think is a fair thing to say. Would you, if you ran, would you consider running as an independent or as a Republican or nothing?
Well, I've been a Republican for almost all of my adult life. And I believe in my brand of Republicanism. I guess what I would say is that I've never run for anything based on whether or not I thought I could win, period. Okay? When I ran for the select board in Swampscott, I had all my friends telling me, oh, don't run for the select board. If you lose, then you'll never be able to run for governor. I was like, I really wanted to do it, so I ran, and thankfully I won. And when... I got into the race in 2010. Governor Patrick and Treasurer Cahill were both already in the race. And I had all kinds of people saying to me, don't do that. You're running against two statewide office holders, name ID, blah, blah, blah. And I did it, and I lost. And then in 2014, I had all kinds of people telling me, you're a loser. Why would you bother to run and lose again?
Really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me?
Boy.
People are tough. People are tough. But I felt I had something to say and something to offer, and I ran. And, you know, we won by about 40,000 votes. So I don't sit around and say to myself, you know, can I win or not? To me, the question always comes back to what I said to you before, which is, do I have the will, the desire, and the agenda that I believe would be in the state's best interest and the energy and the commitment to follow through and deliver on it?
So in light of what you just said about not worrying about losing, I assume that means if you run, you'll run as a Republican or you won't run at all. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's a reasonable assumption to make, yeah.
Okay.
One last quick thing. I know you got to go in a minute. I know you've been trying to get more information from the feds on the Haitian people.
Yeah.
What's going on with Haitian people trying to get here?
We are still waiting for more. We are waiting for more information from the feds. I do appreciate the fact that our congressional delegation also weighed in heavily on this. For your listeners, the process around Afghan refugees has been pretty formalized, pretty processed, understandable, what the benefits were, where they're coming from, what we need to do here or what the sort of nonprofits who do a lot of this work need to do to help people resettle. The Haitian piece has been a lot more complicated. And what I mean by that is folks just kind of show up. And there really hasn't been the same sort of controlled effort around both available resources and who they are and what they qualify for and how we should handle them. And we've been working very closely with a lot of our colleagues in the housing community, in the resettlement community, and the healthcare community, which is where a lot of these folks first get discovered by us, to just solve problems and come up with answers for them. But it's a very less organized and structured process, and we want to help these people, and I would love to have a lot more guidance and a lot more structure from the feds around both what benefits are eligible for and how we're going to actually get to the point where we can actually plan a little bit around this and not feel like we're just scrambling all the time.
And how about the hold up on the non-urgent scheduled procedures? I know there's been big staffing problems in a lot of the hospitals, not to do with COVID, but there's a hold on that.
It's not just the hospitals. I mean, a lot of the folks that folks would get stepped down to, the LTACs, the long-term acute care facilities and the rehab hospitals and the long-term care folks. I mean, there's a staffing shortage at almost every level in the healthcare world right now, which is very similar to the staffing shortage we see in a lot of other places. And as a result, we're short somewhere between 500 and 1,000 beds, depending upon what day it is. And that shortage, especially with this time of year, which is when if you look at the calendar, there's a big bump every year right around now that's usually driven by the flu, but it's also driven in some cases by other respiratory issues and people scheduling surgeries around this time because it's the holidays and they can do the convalescing that they need to do without worrying about other things, or they have family who can look after them. You put that whole thing together, and then you add to the fact that there's also sort of 500, 600 people who test positive for COVID. Not clear how many of them are actually there because they tested positive for COVID. We test everybody who comes into the hospital for COVID for protocol purposes. There's more than 100 of them typically who are there because their appendix burst, they were in a car accident, some other reason. But you add that to the mix along with the other stuff, and it creates a challenge. And so we started talking to the hospitals about this a couple months ago and said, okay, it's coming. We all see it. How do you want to, which makes me sound like a progressive ad, how do you want to handle this? And and they talked to us about this idea of creating a capacity requirement and basically just talking to them every week about how they're doing and making sure that everybody's managing to this capacity requirement, which is not a hard denial. It's basically, if you have the room and you can project you have the room, then, you know, continue to operate according to plan. If you don't think you're going to have the room and you may have capacity issues, then we need you to think about how to space that out a little more. And what we don't want to end up doing is ending up in a situation where we have to literally find beds for people in New Hampshire or Rhode Island or Connecticut, which, by the way, have many of the same problems we do.
How much better is it to talk to a human being in the same room? Is it not?
Way better.
Is it not incredible?
Really? Way better. I can tell when you're giving me a hard time for fun versus when you're giving me a hard time because you mean it.
It's never for fun.
So do the legislature take these same 7 weeks vacations back when you used to work for Bill Well when he was the governor? I mean, was this going on forever? Is this something? Are we getting worse?
I don't remember, to tell you the truth.
I don't remember either.
I'm 65.
We heard that, by the way. It's a bit tad of an obsession, don't you think? Is that hard for you?
Yeah.
Turning 65?
Absolutely.
How so?
It's a big birthday.
I turned 65 like 30 years ago, and I'm...
Well, so the first thing that happens when you turn 65 is you get an email from your doctor that says, you now need to qualify, you now need to enroll in Medicare Part A.
Right,
you have to.
Right.
And it's like,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
That's who I am. Okay.
I know. Everybody's supposed to be retired at 65. That's not happening. The boomers are refusing to retire.
I thought that was kind of an interesting story. Mm-hmm.
Globe piece this weekend for people.
Yeah.
Right. I've always said that, you know, I'm one of these people who's going to want to be purposeful and productive as long as I can be purposeful and productive. I don't have any hobbies. I don't I don't. I read books. That's probably the only hobby I have. I don't golf. I don't do any of. I don't boat. I don't do any of that. I don't fish. I don't do any of that stuff. So, and my wife would lose her mind if I didn't have something useful to do. So I have a feeling I'm going to be hopefully working for a
Jim
long
and I
time.
Have a motto. It's going to take the jaws of life to drag
get us
out of
the studio. Exactly. And then some.
Well, Governor, we'll probably have to break the window for that.
Exactly.
Happy 65. It's good to see you. We really like having you here in person. So thanks for doing it.
I hope you guys have a great few weeks. And I'm assuming I might be back in before Christmas.
I hope
great.
So.
We'd love to see
I
you.
Hope so. That would
great.
Be great.
Right.
Thank you Take very care. Much,
be well,
Governor
Governor.
Baker. We
Thank
very
you
much
so
appreciate
much.
Your time. That was, of course, the voice of Governor Baker, the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We thank him again for coming. Up next, we're going to be joined by the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They're going to discuss the death of Phil Saviano, a fierce advocate for victims of Catholic clergy, sexual abuse, and a lot more. That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are now joined by the all revved up couple. That'd be Reverend Irene Monroe and Emmett Price III. Reverends, great to speak to you both.
Hey, thanks for having us
Happy
back.
Happy Hanukkah.
And to you. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Irene Monroe. I don't celebrate Hanukkah, but why not? You
well, I don't really
Hanukkah.
Celebrate Hanukkah
well, anyway,
either.
It's very nice. It's a very nice.
Should, but it's nice.
But I do.
Okay, yes, you do.
Well, happy Hanukkah to you then, Reverend Monroe.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk about this later in the show with Ann Barrett Doyle, who is from Bishops Accountability, an incredible website that has kept track of all the horrible abuse in the Catholic Church, not just around here, but all around the world. But I did want to touch base with you both about Phil Saviano. He just died at age 69. He was somebody that was relentlessly trying to get attention to the abuse that went on in the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church gave him a measly settlement because he refused to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Because I think Phil thought that was because they thought he was going to die because he was gay, he had AIDS, and this was at a time when most people did die of AIDS. But he was a crusader, and he was depicted in the Academy Award-winning Best Picture Film Spotlight. First, you, Emmett, just some thoughts on Phil Saviano.
I mean, how many ways can we acknowledge this great hero of the Commonwealth and certainly of the nation and perhaps even of the world, somebody who was already on the brink of, you know, when he, I think 1991, you know, AIDS, HIV, and thought he was dying. And so, you know, said, you know, the one thing that I can do is tell the truth. And he told the truth, yeah. And he continued to do it. And then he lived. And then he continued to tell the truth, and then he continued to live, and he continued to yeah. tell the truth. And I think, you know, in the day and age that we live in, where truth is hard to come by,
yeah.
and the honoring of humanity is hard to come by, here's another, you know, absolute voice who's worthy of mention,
yeah.
an absolute hero in this Commonwealth.
Yeah. You know what? Let me tell you what I thought of. He was Me Too before Me Too. I mean, we've got to be honest about
yeah.
that. And what I like is that he turned his what he thought was his personal mess into a universal message about sex abuse in the Catholic Church. We're talking about someone who it's easy to say that, you know, we always talk about, you know, speaking truth to power, but his tenacity really spoke to it because, as you said, Marjorie, this guy was doubly stigmatized. This is a gay man at a time that this wasn't accepted, and he also had AIDS at the time. Yeah. So, of course, he settled for $5,500. He didn't. But they gave him $5,700 to sort of keep him quiet here. But what he did was, I thought of him as Rosa Parks because he refused to shut up and sit down
yeah.
on this issue.
We're talking to the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. And as we said, Ann Barrett Doyle from bishopaccountability.org is going to join us in about 30 minutes and we'll share some other memories and celebration of the incredible life of Phil Saviano. So
I hope he has a state funeral. I just want to say that because I think that I think it's not enough to just. I wish he has a state funeral, and I also hope that that when the anniversary of the exposure of the sexual scandal in the Catholic Church, that his name is always lifted up.
As well,
you know,
it should be.
I think he's going to have a service in the same parish where he was molested.
Oh, I didn't know that.
As a boy all those years ago. Yeah, because people obviously didn't believe him back then. And I thought that was really something.
Well, by the way, speaking of not believing him, it's not clear that the Globe believed him in the beginning either. But it was his relentlessness that really got them on board.
He shook a world. He shook a world. That's why I put him, like, he changed the moral consciousness around this issue here and people understanding what sexual abuse is. That's why I compare him to Rosa Parks, because he yeah. really started a movement unintentionally.
So Ahmaud Arbery's killers, the people who murdered him, all three found guilty of different levels of murder. Faith leaders have spoken out quite strongly, as well they should. We're talking to two faith leaders, starting with you, Irene Monroe. What's your reaction to the 11 white, one black person's jury, really rapid decision in the case of the three men responsible for his murder?
Well, I have to say here, I like many, I was shocked, but I really want to disabuse folks thinking that this was justice as opposed a moment of accountability. What we actually got to see when we look at this particular court case is that the prosecutor, Linda Duncan-Kowski, I don't know how to pronounce
it. I don't either, but she was
close. You're close.
Yeah.
Okay, but my point is she played a brilliant chess game. Clearly she understood, she set the tone and tenor for this trial here, and she understands Southern white people because in this particular trial, again, you had a predominantly white jury. Race was not mentioned except for in her closing argument, but racial tropes were played by the defending attorney, you know, with Arbery supposedly having dirty black nails, too many black pastors, and also asking for more bubbers in the court. But what both this trial as well as the Rittenhouse trial is, it's clearly an example of white fragility. It's like you got to sort of, the elephant elephant in the room is race, but don't mention race, even if they mention race here. And in both of these cases, Rittenhouse and McMichaels and company, it was a hunting expedition. And both, and this case, again, upholds this notion that there's two justice systems. I was just elated that the fact that this Thanksgiving, Arbery's mother could sit at her Thanksgiving table and said, I got my son some justice.
Emmett, what was your reaction?
Well, I was having deja vu. You know, Irene and I recorded a podcast episode that would release on Wednesday. And I listened to her give her comments both then and now. And you know, what's interesting about it, I absolutely agree with her. I think everything she said, and I'll just add this, that Greg McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Rhodey Bryan need to have their names called out so that we know who these convicted murderers are. That we can stop calling it the Ahmaud Arbery case because he was not on trial. And I think the other piece is this, that justice has not necessarily been served, but I think we're getting closer to imagining what justice could look like in this nation. So this is not about justice. This is not about God's justice. This is about can humankind and human beings do what human beings need to do in order to, you know, honor each other as human beings. I mean, that's where it is.
You know, it seems to me, I'm sorry, go ahead, Irene.
I was going to say, and also about justice, we've got to understand this here as we try to crawl to it, is that justice would mean that Arbery would be alive, George Floyd, Trayvon Martin. I mean, all of these young black men who have, you know, lost their lives senselessly to white terrorism, domestic violence. Domestic violence would very much be alive. But I need to say this, that this is really a cautionary tale that you can't lynch a black man as easily as you did in 1950s because of video cameras. Because the real truth is this, where they're not video cameras,
totally.
None of these, whether it's George Floyd or whether we're talking about Arbery's case here, would not get the kind of momentum and attention. And I thought about this in terms of Emmett Till. It took about 40 to 50 years after his death to finally for the truth to come out, where with the video camera, it at least come out within the next 2 to 5 years.
Well, you know what I also thought, too, like the George Floyd case, which was taped, the evidence was so overwhelming in both these cases. I mean, I think there was some concern, okay, it's 11 people, white people on the jury. Are they going to convict this guy? Is the one black person going to have to lead the charge here? But that was, to me, that takes a little bit of the, if they had not convicted in this case, I mean, it would have been just, I can't imagine. You know what I mean? So it wasn't,
I can.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, here's the thing about this, and Irene was very clear about this, that this case was not necessarily won because of the slam dunk evidence. The case was won because of strategic, you know, prowess of the attorney.
Yeah.
Right. The same strategic prowess that got Kyle Rittenhouse off that $2 million defense, you know, was the same similar prowess that this attorney took in not allowing this to be a racialized situation. She played the cards the right way, which is both great, but it's also sad that we're still not dealing with the reality that these guys, these bubbas, got their guns and chased down and hunted this young man.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Irene.
Go ahead. But I just want to say what it also says is, no, we don't rejoice about this because, again, we cannot talk about race, okay, even though that's what the case is about here. So justice would be, again, speaking truth to power. So nothing has really changed. It says that again, you're dealing with an all-white jury. You got to use the technique that the prosecutor used in Arbery's case. Otherwise, we will not get any justice. Evidence means nothing. Evidence means nothing. It's how you're going to play it to an all-white, what we call white fragility in America.
Well, you know, that leads into what I was going to broach with you, too, is it seems to me, in terms of larger significance, while I hope there's no one listening to the show that disagrees that the jury made the only decision they could make here, it seems to me the impact of the conviction will be less significant, far less significant in my mind, than the impact in the civil trial in Charlottesville about the Unite the Right organizers of that rally in 2017 that were they're found liable for, what is it, $26 million in damages. It seems to me that that has potential to have far greater impact on racists in this country and their behavior than the conviction of the McMichaels and Brian. Do you, starting with you, Emmett, do you buy that or no?
Yeah, I think there's something there. I'm not sure if I fully buy it, but I think there's something there to wrestle with. I think the fact that in this civil case, they got to pay up. And, you know, that actually, you feel that, right? In the sense where you have, you know, McMichaels and Brian, you know, it's almost like that was a slam dunk, you know, thank God it happened, but it could have not happened.
Exactly.
Right. That's... So yeah, I think your point, I think you are to something there.
But you know what is tragic? That if you put a money value to something, that money teaches you, you know, that, I mean, that's the unfortunate thing. But you may have a point here, Jim, because I remember a case back almost 20 years ago, this black woman single-handedly won over the KKK because she took over their house. And this was down in the South here. And they turned that house into a community center talking about social justice here. So I think what happens is if you confiscate where they congregate, and that's money lost, that there might be a change. Because I always say this here, you can't legislate behavior, but you could certainly change behavior. So maybe this might be one of the ways here, but the animus will never go away. It's what it is. So I guess it's about controlling the behavior.
We're talking to Emmett Price and Irene Monroe. Emmett, you, I think, answered our question, but maybe a little more fully for a minute about this week's podcast, which I guess is dropping in 2 days. is it all about this trial or what is it?
It is kind of a part two from last week's, mm-hmm. where we started with the Rittenhouse trial.
Yeah.
And then we kind of put these together to look at them.
Compare and contrast.
And so it is about the Ahmaud Arbery, his life. It's about honoring him, but also the notion of the question, is this justice?
Yeah.
Gentlemen and lady, it's great to talk to you. Sorry we're a little bit short today, but the governor
back
was here.
Back at you.
and Irene, happy Hanukkah, if I didn't mention that earlier.
Thank you. And listen, my favorite dessert is rugula, so if you make good rugula, any of you, come by way.
By the way, I don't make it, but boy, do I love it. I am so totally with you. Maybe we'll do that sometime soon. Both of you, thanks for your time. It's really great
Thank
to talk
you.
To you.
Thanks so much.
The Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist in the Boston Voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Emmett G. Price III is founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston and the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. And they host the All Revved Up podcast, which you can get anywhere where you get your podcasts, and it's really fun. Coming up, the Boston Holiday Pops return. Conductor Keith Lockhart is here to preview this season and to remember the great musical genius Stephen Sondheim. Keith Lockhart is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marge Regan and Jim Browning. Just a couple of days, this sound will fill Symphony Hall in Boston for the first time since 2019. Marjorie and I are both smiling. That's right. The Boston Holiday Pops are back. Boston Holiday Pops is back, are back. And joining us now to preview the 3 weeks of performances that, boy, do we need, is conductor Keith Lockhart. Keith, long time. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Likewise, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Good to see you. Good to hear you. And we are back.
Yes, we are thrilled. We are thrilled you are back. But before we get to Holiday Pops, Keith Lockhart, Jim and I were lucky enough to be up in Tanglewood. I think it was 2017 when you did this special tribute to Stephen Sondheim. Let's play a little bit of your conducting him with the Boston Pops up there on Tanglewood. Here it is. Okay. Tell us about it. Stephen Sondheim was 91. People know he just passed away. He was just beyond compare in American musicals, I think. Tell us.
Well, I have to say, Marjorie, I'm devastated by this loss. I mean, of course, we all saw it coming. No one lives forever. But it's as if a great creative light has gone out of the world. And he's someone whose music I have about a 40-year relationship with, and wow. I've done many, many of his shows in many venues. I've celebrated his music really all over the world, as well as right here in Boston. And I always tell people, having met him, having spent some time with him, a couple of hours I spent sitting in his living room talking to him probably 20 years ago, remain one of the most vivid memories I ever have of meeting a single person. And it must be what it would have been like to sit down with Da Vinci or to sit down with Beethoven or Shakespeare. You really got the feeling. And he was a rather modest and self-effacing person in person, but you got the feeling that you were really in the face of genius. And that's gone now. And what we have is the incredible legacy that he left us.
By the way, that Sondheim on Sondheim thing, if that's what it was called at Tanglewood, was one of the great nights ever. It was just brilliant. You and your colleagues were brilliant there, too. So speaking of brilliant, Boston Holiday Pops, December 2nd to December 24th. For the three people in this audience, and I hope there are no more, who've never attended one of those things, Keith Lockhart, tell us about it.
Holiday Pops, I think, is one of Boston's or anywhere's greatest holiday traditions. It is a mix of incredible music that goes all the way from the reflective and the spiritual to the just kind of rip-roaring for fun. Everybody who comes in there, people bring their families, people have brought their families for generations. Everybody comes out infused with the holiday spirit, and I hope just a little better, a little happier, a little more grounded, and a little more in recognition of what these holidays are about.
How's it feel, though, after the hiatus, and everybody knows why? I mean, is it obviously there's some special something, needless to say, and as I said at the intro, boy, do people need it.
I think, for one thing, I'm a little bit nervous just because I haven't worked this hard in a long time. So it's going to be tough to get back into the saddle. We're doing almost as many concerts as we did in the 2019 year, 32 instead of 38 in the hall, and four in some of our outlying friendly venues that we go to year after year. It feels like something that we desperately need, though. I think about each year when I build these programs, what it is that we are celebrating or should be celebrating and what's weighing heavily on our minds. And I think this year, the celebration is about community, because the holidays are about community. They're about interacting with our fellow humanity and kind of figuring out that we have more in common than we might have thought during the rest of the year.
So for those people who are nervous Nellies who've gone every year and want to go again this year, now that you're doing it again, but are, of course, they are freaked out about COVID, what can you tell them?
Well, I understand that, and there are lots of different levels of comfort. As for me personally, having just received my booster shot and all that, I think that eventually we have to come out of our caves and reengage with each other, that this is going to be in one form or another with us for quite a long time to come. But we have taken every precaution that any of the large theatrical venues in the city of Boston have taken to ensure that people can feel comfortable being there. Vaccine or testing mandates, masks while in the hall, except when consuming food and beverage, which, as you know, is a part of Holiday Pops. And there's an even more rigid protocol in place for us performers. I think we can guarantee that people will have a a safe and more importantly, I think, an experience that feels safe when they're with us and can concentrate on the joy of the season and not this thing that's been looming over our heads for far too long.
You know, Keith Lockhart, last year I asked you the following question. And I have to say your answer was totally unsatisfactory. So I'm going to try it again. There is something, part of this wonderful event, and it is, and as I've said to Keith before, on and off the air, this is in the abstract, not my kind of thing at all. Too joyous, too something, too participatory. And you get there and you cannot believe how much unbridled fun every single minute is. But the answer that you got wrong, Keith Lockhart, is there's something called the 12 Days of Christmas. And you always have people from around town who you pick to recite the poem.
And, well, that's the poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas."
Correct. I'm sorry.
Jim the Grinch.
I'm sorry, Brown. The Night Before Christmas. My apologies, not the 12 Days of Christmas. And Marjorie and I have done it a few times. And I asked you last year, we're re-ranked in the pantheon of people around town who had done it. And that's where your answer was thoroughly unsatisfactory. So I'm going to give you a second shot. How did we do as compared to other moderately well-known people in town who have done this through the years, Keith Lockhart?
You two are ranked among the immortals.
That's
right.
Your
number
of course
has been retired.
Of course. Yeah.
We will welcome you back at any time with open arms. You're always welcome on stage with us.
What about your little reindeer hats with the lights? You always wear the little reindeer hats.
I found that to be very attractive, and I think Keith did too. You know, one of the other things I love that you do is you started a couple of years ago, and I don't think it's just around the holiday things, but it's great, these sensory-friendly concerts, which I know is included in this series. Can you explain to people what you're doing and why you're doing it?
I can. We actually started in the spring season in 2019 and then did our very first and only to this point holiday sensory-friendly concert in the 2019 season. Basically, this is a concert very specifically designed for kids and adults who may have problems with the normal way that we present and absorb concerts, who have sensory issues, that too much stimulation, who understand and accept these things in ways different from what we would think is the average everyday audience member. The great thing about these, last year, doing it for the first time at the holidays, we had so many tearful parents and caregivers who came up. And one I remember really well said to me, she said, "You don't know how hard it is for us to ever go out and do anything like a normal family. Because people judge and because people look askance at you and all that." And you understand, you know, not everybody knows where you're coming from, but this is a judgment-free zone with a lot of space between people however people absorb and accept what we're playing for them. If they dance, if they have to move, if it's a little too much and they need to leave the room for a while, all those things are okay.
It's great. I think it's great you did it, and it's great you're continuing to do it. So, Keith Lockhart, again, flesh out the program a little bit for people. And by the way, the Tanglewood Festival chorus is returning, from what I understand. Is that so?
This will, because I find it impossible to do a great holiday show without the vocal tradition, which is such a strong part of it. The TFC has not sung together since February of 2020.
Wow.
And because, as you know, vocal groups have been particularly been very hard hit, but we are bringing them back. They are going to be masked for the performance, which is, a bit of a compromise that we're making for the sake of safety, but they're going to be there, and their wonderful sound is, as usual, going to add so much to what we do there. So we're thrilled to welcome back the Tanglewood Festival chorus. It wouldn't be the holidays without them.
And by the way, speaking of chorus, our friend Lisa Graham and her Metropolitan Chorale do when you go out to the outlying cities, where are the cities you go? Because I think virtually every one of them is in our catchment area, people listening. What are those places, Keith?
Yes, this year there are only four. That's down from five or six in a normal year. We play in Manchester, New Hampshire at the Verizon arena there. We play in Worcester at the lovely theater, and I'll come back to the name on that.
Is it Hanover? Is that what it is?
The Hanover Theater. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Doing this without notes. We play in Lowell Memorial Auditorium, and we play on the campus of UConn.
That's great.
Storrs. So those are great. And yes, Lisa and the Metropolitan Chorale are our house chorus for all of our tour and run out concerts, but also on top of that, because as you can imagine, coming back from an almost 2-year hiatus, the Tanglewood Festival chorus is a little depleted and we're building them back up. Mm-hmm. And the Metropolitan Chorale will be our special guest chorus for some of the concerts in Symphony Hall, side by side.
I didn't know that. That's great.
So I wonder, and we're talking with Keith Lockhart, the conductor of the Boston Pops Orchestra. What kind of things have people been doing in this interim? You mentioned the festival chorus hasn't sung together since February 2020. Singing particularly was thought to be a bad way of transmitting this virus. What have the musicians been doing? I mean, this has been a really difficult drought, obviously.
Well, it's been very hard. I mean, it's obviously as I've talked to with you guys before, the practical implications, especially for our freelance musical community, have been absolutely devastating. As far as the BSO and the Boston Pops are concerned, we had a very strong virtual season last year. We taped in Symphony Hall with a huge COVID protocol, probably 60 pages worth of how we were to do business.
Wow.
And everybody seated so far apart that you kind of had to wave to your section mates. but we did some, I think, excellent programs, something in the range of 14 for the BSO. And about 6 for the Boston Pops, including last year, a virtual holiday concert that I was very proud of. But that having been said, there's nothing like, what we do is perform music live for people and have them experience it.
Yeah.
And the best virtual thing doesn't make up for that. So what have we been doing? Well, outside of that, we've been pretty much doing what everybody else has been doing, binge watching, spending more time with our kids, and waiting to get out of this hole. But you asked me to tell you a little bit what's up the program. I don't know if you have time for that.
Oh, yes, we do.
Okay. Well, I heard the governor was coming, so I wanted to stay.
No, he's already left.
He's gone.
Oh.
You're all set.
So for the program this year, as you know, and you guys have been to several of them, what we try to do is a mix of new experiences, new arrangements, new ways of looking at maybe very familiar music with traditions, things that everybody expects every year. And that's what traditions are about. And obviously this year, I think this is a year people will look to tradition more than ever, just because, I mean, we all are going, where are those things that we used to do? And where are those things that we recognize? And we want to honor that. But we have commissioned two new arrangements, a set of two Mexican carols by a Mexican composer arranger who we have worked with quite a bit. Just gorgeous, kind of along the tradition of Las Posadas, the wonderful Mexican rural tradition about the Christmas season, that are just absolutely delightful. And also from Boston-based musician, incredible musician, David Coleman, who worked with me in last year's spring season when we did a Roots of Jazz concert, a singer, pianist, gospel choir conductor. He conducts the gospel choir at Tufts, and just a wonderful arranger too. He's done a new arrangement of Christmas spirituals for us, done, I think, in a really kind of deep dive, authentic manner that sounds different than anything else we have in our repertoire. I'm very excited about that. But the one piece I'm bringing back that is not a tradition, but that we have done before, is a piece that I had commissioned in 2014 for the 100th anniversary of the event in question. We commissioned it from Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty, the wonderful Broadway pair who've been pals of the Pops for years. And they're the people who gave us Ragtime and Anastasia, mm-hmm. and Seussical and any one of a number of great shows. It's a piece about the story you may know about the Christmas truce of 1914, when the soldiers on both sides of the conflict, all battened down in the trenches, disobeyed their superior officers, took candles, climbed out of their trenches, put their guns down, and went and celebrated Christmas together and exchanged gifts, helped each side bury each other's dead, really a sign of lingering humanity in an absolutely horrific period of time. So we did it for 2014 because that was the 100th anniversary of the event. And I kept thinking, when am I ever going to do that piece again? And this year, a analogy that I've used a lot as we begin to come back out of this is that we're all kind of crawling out of our individual foxholes, our pods, these groups, these things where we've seen, in some cases for 6 months or so, we saw maybe, 8 people, and rejoining the human race together I thought there was something that connected with this idea of, at the end of the day, one of the most important things about the holidays and about Christmas is this sense of community, this sense that we're all in it together, that we are all on this planet, that God loves us all equally, that all of these things that I think the holidays are there to reinforce. And the story struck me as particularly compelling this year, and I wanted to tell it again.
You know, Keith, I don't want to embarrass you, but one of your great skills, and I've said this to you before, is you and your colleagues, but you in particular, really have a tremendous skill at dealing with people at really difficult times in their lives. And this is great. This is happening again. It's great that you're back again, that the POPS is back. By the way, bso.org is where people get tickets. And I say I am the least fun guy on the planet. And this is as much fun as you can possibly imagine for adults, kids, and everything. So good luck with it.
That's going to be our new marketing, Jim. We're going to say, come to the Holiday Pops. They even made Jim Browdy's face.
Exactly.
That's right.
It is huge.
All the Christmas Grinches. That's right.
I couldn't recommend it more. Good luck, Keith. It's great
Thank
to hear
you.
Your voice.
Thanks, guys. See
Thank
you in person
you.
Soon.
Okay.
Please.
Keith Lockhart is conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
And is it as much fun as I say it
it's
is?
It's great.
It
it's
is
great.
Totally
it,
great.
It is great. It is uplifting. The music is unbelievable. There's something different every year. Old people love it. Kids love it.
That's great.
Everybody in between.
It's really great.
Anyway, he's going to be leading the Boston Holiday Pops this season, which starts December 2nd and runs through Christmas Eve. Okay, coming up, we're going to return to our conversation about the legacy of Phil Saviano, one of the heroes and great advocates for victims of clergy sexual abuse. That is next on Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As we've said several times during the show today, Phil Saviano, this fierce advocate for victims of clergy sexual abuse, has died at 69. Here is Phil accepting the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests Pioneer Award in 2015.
Whether your tormentor and abuser was a priest, a minister, a nun, or a rabbi, the wrestling coach, the football coach, the camp counselor, or some TV star, recognize the power within you. Find the courage to speak out, then pass that courage along to some other silent, suffering stranger who will see you or read about you and say, gee, if she can do it, or boy, if he can do it, then maybe I can, too.
My God. Joining us now to discuss his life and legacy is Ann Barrett-Doyle of the group bishopaccountability.org, which archives Catholic clergy abuse and where Phil served on the board. Ann, we're really glad you had time for us today. Good to talk to you.
Oh, good to be here. What a beautiful, beautiful quote you just
Boy,
ran
Boy, was
there.
It ever.
That was lovely.
Yeah, our staff mm-hmm. selected a great one. So, Ann Barrett-Doyle, give people a sense of Phil's contribution, and also tell us about him as a person.
Oh, my gosh. Well, his contribution was one of a kind. I mean, he changed history. In the early 90s, he became maybe the first clergy sex abuse survivor in the U.S. or in the world to sue the Catholic Church but refuse to sign a gag order yes. when he settled. And that really crucial decision enabled Phil to keep reaching out to other survivors. And he was just someone who kept figuring out how to turn catastrophe into positive impact. And he did it all in this extremely low-key, matter-of-fact way of his. You know, he started the New England chapter of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests in 1997. He went public with the story of his sexual abuse in the 1990s in the Boston Globe. And he did all of this at a time when just about no one else was yeah. doing it. It had to have been so lonely. And he just carried his courage and his grace in such a quiet way. I just felt better when I was with Phil. We traveled to Rome a couple of times together in 2019 and 2020. And he just had a way of noticing beauty. He liked to talk about a wide variety of subjects besides abuse. He was deeply kind and compassionate, and he just had this gift of being absolutely precise about the horrors he was describing and of the cover-up without getting shrill or even seeming angry, and that made him all the more powerful.
You know, it's, you know, the beautiful words you're speaking about him. Judy Collins was in our studio a few years ago and totally out of – I didn't know at the time
that
she and Phil were as close as they were. And out of nowhere, I can't remember what the – there wasn't even a transition. Judy Collins, because she's in Boston, just started talking about Phil Saviano in the same sort of incredible way that you did. And it, I don't know if I've ever spoken to a human being, Ann Barrett-Doyle, who Phil – Saviano got in touch with, who doesn't speak about him like you and Judy Collins do. I mean, it's just, by the way, apart from his pioneering, legendary, courageous work, just Phil as a human being.
Yes, yeah. And you know, we just got an email from a survivor saying, Phil Saviano saved my life. It is impossible to calculate, you know, how many victims were saved by him and how many children whose abuse was prevented by him. You know, he was just incredibly smart. And he, for instance, you know, he knew, you know, long before everyone else did that the problem was the cover-up. You know,
right.
He was so savvy. He was able to get from the Worcester Diocese in the 90s the documents that show that seven bishops had transferred his abuser from one state and one diocese to another. And he was trying to tell the Boston Globe this in 1998. And of course, we all know it's legend now that they finally were able to listen in 2001 and 2002. And now we see that this same cover-up was orchestrated, you know, globally by the Catholic Church.
Well, you know, I remember back then when there would be these trials before, you know, Phil Saviano came along, where the line was always, oh, well, these kids, they're all trying to make money off the Catholic Church now. You know, they're lying. Even when it was two brothers in the same family saying exactly the same thing. So when he went into the church with all his documentations, and there's a scene in the Academy Award-winning movie, Best Picture.
In the Globe, not
Spotlight,
in the church.
Went into the Globe with his documents. And they finally did believe him the second time around. Marty Baron had come in to run the Globe at that point. He blew the lid off this whole thing because Saviano got the Globe started, and then the Globe went after the court records. And as we all know, suddenly we found out that we're talking about thousands of kids and hundreds of priests.
Yes. Yes, I mean, he was an archivist, which is one reason we were so thrilled at Bishop Accountability when he agreed to be on our board. He was an archivist. He recognized that it was about the documents. You had to get the documents, and he kept orderly files. He was an incredibly tidy person, and he had everything at his fingertips. He was an organized, lucid thinker, and I don't know. You know, he was the whole package. He was also a terrific communicator. I mean, he could communicate so lucidly and simply. You just got it. And it was just a privilege to be his friend. And it was very fun to travel with him because he enjoyed tiramisu, I remember. him ordering at restaurants, and we went to Naples after being in Rome because he wanted to collect a few of these gorgeous, I think, papier-mâché angels that he would sell on his website. He sold, you know, he collected from art from artisans and sold them on his website. So he was just a delightful, multifaceted human, but his focus ultimately was always on empowering other survivors.
We're talking to Ann Barrett Doyle from Bishop Accountability. And, you know, I've talked to you a lot about what the church has and hasn't done since this Spotlight series back in the early 2000s. The church claims it's doing...
And we should say the Boston Phoenix early
the Boston
on
Phoenix,
too.
Yep.
Yeah.
That they cleaned it up. I think you people at Bishop Accountability who keep a record of all this. Have they cleaned it up?
Oh, not by a long shot. No, they haven't. They have definitely. It's not that we haven't made an impact. It's not that Phil's impact, all his work was for naught. No, they've come a long way, but I think they still have this very priest privilege heavy system that makes it very hard to convict a priest under canon law. And makes it very hard to punish a bishop who covers up. And in many countries, I mean, there's been a lot of progress made here in the United States, especially in certain states and certain dioceses like Boston, whereas other states like Florida and Texas, you've seen very little transparency and accountability by the Catholic Church because of their statute of limitations. And there are certain countries in the world that are just just emerging, like Poland and countries in South America, Mexico and Philippines and Brazil. These are enormous Catholic countries where this crisis is barely been exposed.
Having said that, Phil Saviano changed
there.
The world.
We'll get there.
Exactly.
Hey, Anne, thank you for your time as always. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. That was the voice of Anne Barrett Doyle. She's from Bishop Accountability, a great website which chronicles all this abuse. Tomorrow, I want to thank you for listening today. Tomorrow, Ed Markey's going to be with us. What are you doing on TV, Jim?
We're going to continue the discussion we have with the Revs about the significance of the Charlottesville decision, the McMichaels and Brian being convicted, Rittenhouse with Ron Sullivan and Renee Graham. We're going to pay tribute to Phil Saviano, playing part of a couple of interviews that I did with him on my show. And for a lighter touch, Dan Shaughnessy is going to continue to talk about that wonderful book of his that you and I have both read about the Larry Bird years with the Celtics. That's all tonight at 7 o'clock.
We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, and Rebecca Taubar, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, as well. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
I hope you can tune in again tomorrow and have a great day.